Good morning. We will call the March 15th, 2023 Board of Directors meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District to order. We always start our meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. Director Armstrong, would you be so kind as to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning?
Yes. Well, please face the flag. Ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
April, do we have
anyone in attendance wishing to do public comment on any item not on the agenda this morning?
Not that I'm aware of.
Very good. I know we have a few guests here for item C who would like to do public comment. After our executive reports, I'm going to move item C up on the agenda, and we will take that right after our executive reports. So with that, can I ask our secretary to take the role of the board and also read the suggestions for virtually attending the meeting?
Absolutely. First, we'll do roll call. So we have President Pauley and Director Slauson.
Present.
And Director Armstrong.
Here.
Director Record and Corona are both absent. Our legal counsel is here. I will be going over the guidelines for virtual participation in EMWD board meetings. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking.
Thank you very much for that. I also understand Director Corona may be joining us a little later in the meeting today. With that, we will go to item two, which is our executive reports. I'll ask the General Manager, Mr. Mawand, if he would go to the podium, please.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. I wanted to cover a few items this morning. Under new and ongoing items, the last couple weeks, our staff has rallied to pull together 8 separate applications for earmark funding. That's the congressional project community funding opportunities that we've pursued in the past. For this year, we submitted on our purified water replenishment as well as our South Paris desalination project for $5 million and $6 million, respectively, to both Senators Feinstein and Senators Padilla. In addition to our House representatives for Congressman Calvert, we submitted a project that includes various improvements, as you're familiar, for our water booster stations with the potential for PSPS events. We need backup power generation to continue that reliable supply of water. Also for Congressman Ruiz, we submitted the groundwater treatment facility over in San Jacinto for consideration of up to $5 million. Congressman Issa, we submitted a project to construct recycled water pipelines within the French Valley community. And Congressman Takano, we are requesting up to $5 million in earmark funding for the Cactus II feeder in Moreno Valley. So in addition to those submittals, we are meeting individually with representatives of each of the House members' district staff, as well as the senator's staff. So it's an ongoing effort this week, as well as last week. So we will keep you apprised of the developments, but we're hopeful that the congressional delegates will consider our earmark funding requests. Next item I wanted to share with you, as you're aware, with the continued precipitation and increasing snowpack up north, we are having conversations with the Metropolitan Water District about the potential for essentially what's called Article 21 water on the State Water Project. Essentially, it's excess water above the State Water Project contractor's allocation. And those conversations are regarding our cyclic storage program. Specifically, if you recall back in 2019 when we were in similar conditions, Metropolitan did extend excess water to us that we took advantage of, and we are ready to take advantage of that excess water. In fact, we are updating that agreement that was previously established with Metropolitan up to the 2023 rates. Essentially, what we would do is we would rest our wells in Hemet San Jacinto and allow us to purchase more water and store that water and get credit for that stored water. In addition, we have facilitated a conversation between Metropolitan and Rancho California Water District, who, again, in 2019 also took advantage and participated in the same program. Beyond the work that's ongoing with Metropolitan and those conversations, we're also talking to San Bernardino Valley Municipal Water District. As you know, the SARCA program allows San Bernardino to extend excess water, since they are a direct state water project contractors to EMWD and the other SARCA participants. So we're gauging their position and understanding if they'll have excess water to us. If that water is available, then again, we have the ability to take that water, whether it's through wheeling, through our system, to Mountain Avenue West, or through banking in another groundwater aquifer and getting credit for it. So we're working through those opportunities, but it is becoming increasingly apparent that excess water for local storage is going to be available. Metropolitan has prioritized replenishment of their regional storage, including Diamond Valley Lake. In fact, this week, they are switching over the Mills plant from Diamond Valley Lake Supply to essentially State Water Project supplies. So things are starting to change very quickly, and Met will start to replenish Diamond Valley Lake later this month. Next item, I wanted to share with the board that yesterday the EPA released proposed MCLs for PFAS, specifically for PFOA and PFOA, as well as four additional PFAS variants that are listed here in my report. They've established the proposed MCL at 4 parts per trillion, significantly lower than the previous federal advisory. In addition to the proposed lower limits as part of the MCL, they are requiring public water systems to monitor for PFAS at the lower levels, as well as notify the public of potential PFAS contamination and take action if the water supply exceeds those new limits. So we will be working with our associations. There's a public review period associated with the proposed MCL, and we will be providing comments and feedback through our associations to the EPA accordingly. Under items of interest to the board, wanted to share with you that Director Slauson, myself, and other staff had the opportunity to host Supervisor Exchin Gutierrez recently. And it was really a great opportunity to share with the new supervisor everything that EMWD has undertaken over the last many years and current initiatives to increase our local water supply resiliency, as well as improvements in our infrastructure and enhancements in our capabilities. After the meeting in our offices, we had the opportunity to tour the San Jacinto reclamation facility and show the supervisor where the new purified water replenishment facility will be constructed, as well as some of the investments that we'll be making within his district. Supervisor was very complimentary of EMWD and indicated that he will take our request for additional ARPA funding back to his team, and we should be hearing from him hopefully soon. Next item I wanted to share with the board, as you know, this organization's commitment to safety has been longstanding. In fact, since 1999, we have been certified as a Cal OSHA California Voluntary Protection Program, CalSTAR, agency. And every 3 years, we go through a recertification process with Cal OSHA. We are gearing up for the next recertification, which will occur in June to July of this year. There will be a team of Cal OSHA staff that will come out to our facility. They'll spend about a week. They will inspect our programs, look at our safety protocols, look at our construction procedures, basically interview up to 20% of our staff through this process. So it's a very exhaustive site inspection and review of all of our safety requirements and protocols. And as a result of that site visit, they will issue a report where there's potentially improvements that we can undertake, and we have 90 days to incorporate and address those improvements. So it's a process that we've undertaken every 3 years, and we're looking forward to working with the Cal OSHA team when they come on site later this year in June. Also, I wanted to share with the board that tomorrow we will host a delegation from the Future Farmers of America, students and teachers from Kern County. Future Farmers of America program will be visiting us to learn more about our local supplies, including our support of agricultural in our community, use of recycled water, and our various investments in local water supplies. They will also tour our Paris 2 desalination facility. And so it'll be a great opportunity to share with that delegation everything we've done in support of ag and everything we're planning on doing in the future. They are on a tour of Southern California, and that will conclude in a convention that will take place in Ontario. There are a couple items not on my report that I wanted to share with the board. One is that this week, President Pauly and I had the opportunity to meet with the general manager as well as board president of Nuevo Lakeview Water Company. It's a local water company that is within our service area, and they rely on us for about half of their water supply. It was a really good conversation. We discussed a number of opportunities for collaboration, reiterate our continued support of Nuevo Water Company when it comes to their water needs, and talked about future collaboration to look at, for example, wells they have decommissioned that we can potentially repurpose for our desalination program and other opportunities. So it was a very fruitful conversation. Look forward to future discussions with them. We plan on meeting on a regular basis and to coordinate our efforts and theirs. And finally, late yesterday, we did hear that there was a court ruling in the matter of the San Diego County Water Authority versus Metropolitan Water District, and I'm certain that our legal counsel would like to update the board on that matter as well.
Sure. Thanks, Joe. As the board may recall, the district has been a co-defendant real party in interest with a number of other metropolitan member agencies in a lawsuit filed by San Diego that began in 2010. And the lawsuit was a challenge to the district's rates and also included an allegation that the Metropolitan's rates, and that the lawsuit had a breach of contract element to it, where San Diego claimed that Metropolitan had breached the 2003 exchange agreement, which was reached as part of the quantification settlement agreements concerning Colorado River water many years ago. And this litigation has been ongoing for quite a while. There were some previous trials concerning the way that MET was allocating one of its rate components, it's the water stewardship rate, considering that to be a transportation rate. But more importantly and more recently, there was a trial that concluded in September where San Diego was claiming that Metropolitan was in breach of the 2003 exchange agreement by not providing San Diego what are called offsetting benefits. I won't bore you with the details on the weeds on what that means, but essentially San Diego was suing Metropolitan for $334 million. The case was tried again. It ended in September. There was some post-trial briefing. And yesterday we received a tentative ruling in favor of Metropolitan. The court ruled that Metropolitan did not breach the contract because San Diego is not entitled to those offsetting benefits. There is an opportunity for San Diego to contest that tentative ruling, but we expect that ruling is going to hold. So it's very good news for Metropolitan. They were seeking $334 million, and San Diego was denied.
Thank you, Stephen. With that, President Pauly, members of the board, myself or Stephen would be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions on any of these items?
I guess on the Met-San Diego case, so in that type of ruling, San Diego pays their own attorney fees?
Yes. Well, that's a good question. I don't know if there will be any post-trial litigation over attorney's fees, but the contract would determine whether or not there is a prevailing party provision. And frankly, as I sit here, I don't know the answer to that, but we'll see pretty shortly after the ruling is final whether or not that's going to be contested.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate it. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Yes, just briefly. I wanted to mention, I'm sure all of you have heard about the two significant bank failures last weekend relating to Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. I just want you to assure the board that EMWD has no direct relationship with either of those banks. Following the bank failures, there was some market volatility in the equity and fixed income markets, with two-year treasuries dropping about 100 basis points the following day. There's still a bit of uncertainty as to what the Federal Reserve will do with interest rates, but they're going to meet this week, and we'll keep on top of that, and we'll keep on top of anything that any indirect exposure to the district as this unfolds. So I just wanted to share that with the board.
All right. Thank you very much. Nick, anything for
Nothing
us this
today.
Morning?
Nothing.
Nothing. Matt?
Good morning. Just really
briefly wanted to say that we're still doing pretty well with all these weather events. This afternoon we'll survey the system again, but so far no reports of any overflows or any of those issues. As of this morning, we had recharged 1,429 acre feet at Grand Avenue, so doing really well there. But the ponds down there are now full, so we'll continue to put as much water as we have space for. And as expected, recycled water demands are still low, and as of this morning, we're at 4,422 acre feet discharged. That's it.
Very good. Any questions for anybody? All right. Very good. As I indicated, we're going to deviate a little on our agenda here because I know we have many people wishing to hear item 4C. And so at this time, we will go to item 4C, which is to adopt a three proposed resolutions of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District for the annexation of the 114th Fringe Area to Eastern Municipal Water District and the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. I'm Chris Teague, the district's real property manager. I'll be covering most of the fringe area-related proceedings this morning. Joe Broadhead, the district's principal water resources specialist, will be covering CEQA for fringe area annexation as well as the overall project. All right, first, a brief background. Lands must be annexed to Metropolitan Water District in order to receive municipal water service. The Los Alamos Hills area is located within the city of Marietta, is within EMWD's sphere of influence, but is not in district service territory. The Los Alamos Hills property owners rely on privately owned groundwater wells. Throughout the years, they faced dry well conditions, necessitating water to be trucked into the area to fill their individual storage tanks. Inquiries from these residents about municipal water service have been received by both EMWD as well as City of Marietta staff. Dry wells are a safety and sanitary concern. Additionally, there was a fire in the area a number of years ago that was challenging to extinguish because of the lack of water infrastructure. All of this led to the city and Eastern working collaboratively towards providing a municipal water service solution. The exhibit on screen shows the Los Alamos Hills area highlighted in yellow, represents 50 parcels totaling just over 171 acres. Los Alamos Hills is located east of IA-215, south of Clinton Keith, and north of Marietta Hot Springs Road. The blue dashed line depicts EMWD's service territory. Internally, we refer to this area of the city as the Marietta Keyhole, and it represents one of the few unannexed areas within Eastern's external service boundary. All of the areas surrounding the keyhole are annexed and served by Eastern. The $3 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds received by the City of Marietta were a significant driver in advancing this infrastructure project. The city and EMWD, as I mentioned, have collaborated over the past year to begin the process of bringing municipal water service to the Los Alamos Hills area. One of the major milestones of the collaboration was the approval and execution of the interagency financial contribution agreement. Eastern's board approved this agreement in early July 22, and it provided a pathway for payment of ARPA funds to Eastern with $1.5 million received to date. Another important milestone was the approval of the Los Alamos Hills Water System Financing Program in November 22, providing these residents an option to finance MWD acreage-based fees as well as EMWD connection charges was really instrumental in the level of participation that was received. In October of 2022, EMWD, as well as the City of Murrieta, hosted a town hall meeting where attendees heard about the proposed project, its benefits, as well as the annexation process and associated costs and schedule. As you can see from the photo on the lower left, where President Pauley is waving to the crowd, there was significant community interest and participation. The event lasted most of the evening, and members of the board, executive staff, as well as representatives from the city, public and government affairs, engineering, and Eastern's finance team engaged with the community to respond to questions, as well as hear about the community's needs and concerns. The initial outreach meeting was followed by the financing program agreement signing events. Those were in early December and January of this year. 36 of the 50 property owners signed financing agreements or will be paying the fees associated with the annexation up front. These 36 parcels represent more than 101 acres out of the 171 Los Alamos Hills area makeup. And the image there is a few district staff who are authorized notaries. The parcels in green, the image on screen, indicate owners that did sign the financing agreements or have otherwise committed to the annexation. These 36 properties will be advanced to Metropolitan and LAFCO for consideration to be annexed. The parcels in gray are not included in the annexation proceedings before you today. EMWD will lead the fringe area annexation proceedings. We're currently on step one of four major process steps, which are bound by the blue vertical lines and underlined by the 14 to 18 month processing timeline. Metropolitan is the second major step, and given the timeline shown on screen, MWD should consider the annexation request no later than September of this year. LAFCO is the third step, and staff expect that they would approve by February of 24, and then the last step is returning before this board in approximately April of next year. This is a conservative schedule, and if any of the agencies process the request faster than anticipated, real property staff, myself, will advance proceedings to the next agency. Most importantly, the annexation proceedings are anticipated to be finalized before construction completion. Really quick review of some key milestones. Again, the financing agreements needed to be signed in early January. LAFCO and annexation process begins this month, what we're here today to discuss. CEQA will be complete next month. The next three bullets are in reference to the construction project, so preliminary and final design are expected to be complete in June. Construction bid and contract award anticipated in September of this year. Construction completion in the fall of next year. And, you know, most importantly, that's well before the ARPA funding deadline of December 2026. So now I'll turn it over to Joe Broadhead to cover CEQA.
Chris? Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. The district prepared a CEQA initial study to analyze the potential impacts of the proposed project to determine whether a mitigated NCDEC or environmental impact report would be required. And at the conclusion of the analysis, it was determined that mitigation would be required for the three impact areas that you see here on the slide: biological resources, geology, soils, and noise. And at the end of the analysis, it was concluded that all of the project impacts would be less than significant with the mitigation. So therefore, mitigated NAICS deck was the appropriate vehicle for the project. For public review, we sent out consultation letters to area tribes, and they either declined consultation or they didn't respond, so then we moved on to releasing the document for public review and comment. Public review and comment occurred from January 24th to February 23rd of this year. To kick it off, we sent the notice of intent to the Press Enterprise. I had it posted within the Press Enterprise for public consumption. We sent the notice of intent to Riverside County for posting, to the State Clearinghouse, to various agencies and landowners within the proposed annexation area. We also put electronic copy of the document on our district website, and hard copies were made available at the administrative offices for anybody that wanted to come in and take a look at the document. The notice of intent indicated that that's where they could go to take a look at the document if they wished. At the end of the comment period, we received two comment letters, one from the Augustan Band of Kaweah Indians and the other one from a resident, Mr. Bob Landweer. Neither of the two comment letters resulted in a modification of the impacts or the mitigation measures that were in the publicly released initial study mitigated NAICS deck. Mr. Landweer's letter did result in a minor modification of the project description for an explicit inclusion of fire hydrants to be part of the project. So that addition is on page 10 of the initial study mitigated NAICS deck, which is part of the board packet today. Both those comments and staff's responses to comments are included in the final initial study mitigated NAICS deck, which is part of the board package. Staff's position is that it's appropriate to process the mitigated NAICS deck for this project, and this project was defined as the annexation of various parcels as well as the development of a water pipeline project. And that is it for the CEQA review. I can either take questions now or at the end.
Any questions on the CEQA portion of this?
No, no questions.
No. Okay, thank you.
All right. So wrapping up, on behalf of the participating property owners, EMWD will request via resolution concurrent annexation to Metropolitan and Eastern Service Territory. The resolution of MED is relatively simple, in that we're just requesting annexation of the subject lands. Again, once MET considers the request and with their anticipated approval, EMWD will then submit a resolution to LAFCO for reorganization proceeding. Key points with the LAFCO resolution are that the proposed reorganization request is within EMWD's sphere of influence. Property owners are obligated to pay expenses related to the reorganization. Reasons for the reorg are that the area lacks sufficient local natural groundwater, as well as to address safety and sanitary concerns, that the board certifies CEQA, and finally, that there is no transfer of ad valorem property tax revenue with the County of Riverside, no exchange. So with that, staff recommend that the board approve and authorize three resolutions. The first, the Los Alamos Hills Water System Project Initial Study, Mitigated Negative Declaration and Mitigation Monitoring and Reporting Program. Second resolution to Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. For this, the Eastern's 114th Fringe Area Annexation. And third, to LAFCO for EMWD's 114th Fringe Area Annexation. Additionally, staff recommend that the board approve and authorize the Los Alamos Hills System Water Project and approve the legal description, map, and authorize staff to distribute funds necessary for the subject annexation. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Any questions? Chris, I want to go back on the LAFCO timeline on this. It was, I don't know if you have the slide available, but it... If you don't, that's fine,
too. It's right here.
There okay. So we're still looking at a LAFCO process of 6 months? That still concerns me, and it's since we started this process, that would be...
Yeah,
I was going to jump in here, President Pauly. I know that you've challenged us with regards to this timeline. I will share that what Chris is presenting is the... is a typical timeline that we would expect for this process. Chris and his team actually have been reaching out ahead to Metropolitan and LAFCO, looking for opportunities where we can accelerate this. I will, share that the feedback that I've received is that we think we're going to easily beat this timeline. This is standard, but we can't commit to anything faster than this, but I'm confident that we'll be able to do this ahead of this timeline, and as Chris pointed out, well in advance as to the construction completion.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that LAFCO understands that some of the funding on this has a hard deadline to it. So on something that I just want to make sure we communicate that to.
I'll definitely relay that to them.
So, all right, if there's no other questions, I understand we have a number of speakers on this issue. When you speak, we welcome you to the podium here. We have a little clock. We limit people to 3 minutes or less, if you could keep your comments into that time frame. And if we could, why don't we start with Councilman Holliday? Thank you for being here, sir.
Certainly. Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. Thank you to have the opportunity to speak before you today. Newly elected to District 2 of the Murrieta City Council. This project was approved prior to me being on council, but I supported it as a landowner, not within this district, to proposed district, but in the area. I've been a longtime Murrieta resident, and this project is desperately needed, and I wanted to be here to share my support for this project today. It has invaluable safety, public safety aspects for the city, and some ancillary benefits for some of the residents as well. So I encourage you to support this 100%. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments, sir. I understand we have three people that would like to donate their time. So I'm just going to make sure that here we have Leah Morrow. Are you in the audience? Right there? Okay, very good. I know you got your hands full back there. So Teresa Morrow, okay. Okay, in the back, okay. And Seth Morrow?
In the lobby as well.
Okay. And they all wanted to donate time to Bob Landwehr. Is that my understanding?
Correct.
Okay. So that would give, including Mr. Landwehr's 3 minutes, that would give him 12 minutes to speak. I will also note that Director Corona has joined us.
Morning.
Director Corona, we are on item 4C. Go ahead, sir, for your 12
Thank
minutes.
Thank you. I live at the corner of Los Alamos and Celia, 27961 Celia Road.
Mr. Armstrong, thank you.
November 16th, when I spoke, I was pretty irate. I had found out the day before that my neighbor that surrounds me wanted to put in multifamily homes, and I didn't want that to happen. The other thing is when I looked at the PowerPoint presentation, we had a one-day notice, and we didn't make it. But the PowerPoint presentation at the bottom, it said once annexation is complete, each property owner will be required to pay for annexation into both Murrieta Water and EMWD, as well as payment of connection fees. We get plenty of water, and I thought we were mandated, if annexation occurs, that we got to pay. And so... at our place, all the water comes downhill, so it goes on the east side of Celia Road. There's two 36-inch culverts. Everybody's water comes that way. Then it comes through our property. We sit on the front porch, and it's a pretty river this morning. And all this water comes through, goes to the left side of our property where our well is. And then we have all the water from right diagonally across from the sports park. We get a lot of water, so I didn't want to have to pay for more water. So thank you when you asked questions on the 16th. That was the first time I learned that it wasn't mandatory. So thank you for asking those questions. The intent of CEQA to inform government decision makers and the public about the potential environmental effects of proposed activities. To prevent significant avoidable environmental damage. The fire hydrants, where are they located? There's going to be 30 of them. How's the runoff going to be mitigated in areas where there's no hardscape? We're on a dirt road. And where is all that water going when one of them pops? We know because any fire you go to, if there's a lot of fire, there's a lot of water. And so this is a good project, don't get me wrong. But there needs to be some more mitigation. There needs to be some more answers about some questions that I have. Where does all that water go? And so we know that we have electrical vehicles that are operated by lithium-ion batteries. They contain toxins, carcinogens. So when those car fires of the future happen and the fire department gets there, which they're going to be there for hours, and they put volumes and volumes of water on that, that water comes down to our property, to our well. Is there going to be any conversation about that? Isn't that the purpose of this? If it's predictable, is it preventable? Isn't there going to be some discussion about that? There's no speculation, in my opinion, about this. That's the purpose of the fire hydrants going in, is to put out fires. The more fire you have, the hotter the fire you have, the longer the fire that you have, the more water you need. According to Fire Hazard Planning Technical Advisory, published by the Governor's Office of Planning and Research, August 2022, if located in or near state responsibility areas or lands classified as very high fire hazard severity zones, would the project expose people or structures to significant risk, including downslope or downstream flooding or landslides as a result of the runoff, post-fire slope instability, or drainage changes? Yes, it does. Where's that conversation at? Where's it at in the CEQA document? The authority having jurisdiction on this issue, specifically the fire hydrants, is the city of Marietta. They're the ones that decide through the fire chief and the city engineer. That's the authority that decides this. Where was our opportunity as residents involved, affected by this project, to talk to them about it? It hasn't occurred. I know pretty good idea that because we're so far away from a nearby fire hydrant, we're on the corner. One's going to end up on my property or near my property somewhere. If you look at our place, as you come down Celia Road towards Los Alamos, you'll see some garages, and they're below the road. So is that where one's going to go? Don't I have the opportunity to talk to the fire department chief, to the engineer there, and have some open discussion about this? During the summer, when it gets real hot and this river of water is no longer there and it's just a riverbed that's got a lot of sand in it, our kids play in it. And I'm referring to Teresa's our oldest. We moved there when she was five. The redhead kid, who's four, Leah, and the son, Seth, two, they like playing in the sand. We want them to play there. They have four other cousins. All of them are under four. We want them to play. So what happens? I know if it, I'm, and this may be awkward, but shouldn't we at least have some dialogue? During the summer when we see a monsoon coming and it's stinking hot, we make sure the kids are out. We don't want anybody down there because it's literally like a little flash flood. Well, the same situation exists for our family, in my opinion, when one of the fire hydrants gets knocked over down the road and the water comes that way. Will we know about it? Well, if there's fire engines going down the road, we will. But if one gets popped by one of my, we love it. We love our neighbors. We live in a great neighborhood. But a well-meaning neighbor just working and the top of his backhoe hits the top of a fire hydrant and tips it over. That water, like the pictures I described in there, or that you saw, creates flooding. And that water comes through our place. I don't want our grandkids in there playing when that happens. The city of Marietta is funding the project. $3 million ARPA funds. But this next part, which it says, shall endeavor to identify and contribute other potential additional sources of funding received or otherwise made available for district's costs, fees, and expenses incurred in connection with the district's construction of said water infrastructure. They pretty much wrote a blank contract, put this thing together. I mean, I understand ARPA funds are important and are a big part of it, but they don't expire until December of 2026. What is the rush? If you listen to the city council meeting, we got to do this expeditiously. We have to get it done fast. Well, in doing so, you left a lot of us out. Why did the district pass on the annexation costs to parcel owners when they're covered by ARPA? $750,000? Where'd it go? This project's 101 acres, 7,500 an acre, $757,500. If you listen to the city council, annexation costs will be covered by ARPA funds. If that's true, it's in writing that was said, why then are the parcel owners paying the annexation cost? Why is that happening? Anybody from the city, could you explain it to me?
Sir, if you could address the comments to the board here.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you were to look at the organizational chart at the city of Marietta, at the top is the citizens. We're supposed to have the right to tell our representatives what we want. I wasn't invited, our family wasn't invited to that. And I don't know if there was ever a formal invitation about this project on behalf of the city, on behalf of the water district. Hey, the folks funding this project, your tax dollars, about this project affecting you, you can speak to your representatives and ask what you would like. Tell them what you would like. That didn't happen here. Who has jurisdiction on the placement of the fire hydrants? I would like to be able to have some input as to that. What's the plan? Where are they going? 5 years ago, about Southern California, gas company guy showed up at my front door. He said, I need to talk to you about the gas meter. Let's go out to it. It's right off Los Alamos Road. He says, well, we got a problem because it's too close to the road and it's a high-pressure gas line. And the CPUC is asking the gas company to protect these lines, these meters. So what the gas company that we want to do is do that. So we're going to put it in an underground vault. And so we're thinking about moving it back this way. And I said, well, that's not a good place because that's our driveway to get to the back of the property. And he goes, well, how about further back over there? And I said, you know, it may not look like anything to you because it's dry right now. But when it rains, it's a river. There's a lot of water that goes through. In fact, if you look a little bit further where that driveway is next to the wall in 95, that all washed away, including the culvert, because of the floods. In fact, FEMA came in and they paid for the repair. They put the paid for the culvert being placed in the driveway. So we can't put it there. So I go, do you have any other ideas? And he said, well, we can put these posts, these bollards, I think you refer to them as.
I just want to give your 12 minutes or about up here.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Okay. Anyway, there was discussion. No, we got boulders. We have a quarry in Temecula. We can get some boulders, and we'll put them right here. And I said, well, the problem isn't so much right in front of the meter. It's because of the traffic flying.
Sir, I'm going to have to stop you,
okay?
We've gone to your 12 minutes. I want
to anyway,
make sure.
There was the opportunity to have a discussion, to talk to someone, and I was hoping that would be the opportunity here. Thank you.
All right, our next speaker is Belinda Covington, please. Welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm Belinda Covington, and I'm speaking on behalf of my parents, Rigoberto and Maria Eva Quiroz, that are sitting back there in the corner. I just wanted, or we wanted, to thank you first for allowing us to be here and speak, and for always communicating when the board meetings are going to be taking place to give us the opportunity to attend and speak on behalf of the Los Alamos Hills Water Project. So thank you very much for that. Really quick, I don't know if I've ever mentioned it to this board, but I know I've mentioned it to the Murrieta City Board. My parents have lived on Celia Road on their property for 40 years, maybe more. And they have been praying and fighting for water to come into this community for 40 years. And for this to be happening in their lifetime is a true blessing, and they're very thankful and appreciative of City of Murrieta, Eastern Municipal Water District, for our kind neighbor Alan Long, who's sitting back there, for his guidance and his help in informing us and always keeping us on top of this project. It's really a great thing for our community. So I just want to make it very clear that other than my sisters and I, nobody really speaks for my parents. Like, they are 100% for this project. They are for step one, step two, step three, however many steps needed to be to get to the end for the fire hydrants. We are 100% on board. We 100%, like, we have no questions as to why this is happening. Like, we know why this is happening, because it's needed. The hydrants are needed. The water is needed. There have been times where my dad has had to carry water, hauling water into his property because we've had no water in our well. So this to us is a miracle, really. And we're very appreciative, again, for the City of Murrieta, for the Eastern Municipal Water District, for their part in it. And we continue to support it. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Our next speaker will be Mr. Ivan Haller. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, President Polity, members of the board. I'm Ivan Haller. I'm an assistant city manager for the City of Murrieta. And I want to start by saying that on behalf of the city, we remain strongly in support of this project. I would like to just offer a couple of comments. This would not be possible without the use of ARPA funds. Clearly, the city is not a water purveyor, and we don't spend money on water or sewer infrastructure. However, ARPA funds made it possible for us to participate in this. And the city council determined to allocate a portion of the ARPA funds that we received to this project because they recognized the importance not only to the residents of the area from having municipal potable water service, but also from a fire protection standpoint. And when we did have meetings to discuss allocation of ARPA funds, as I recall, there were 20 or so residents from this area that came to speak on that topic to the city council. So I will close my remarks by just restating again, the city strongly supports this and encourages your board to adopt the recommendations and the resolution in front of you. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, sir. I have a Maria Cruzos and a Ringberto Cruzos, both you, and I understand they want to donate their time to Alan Long, correct? So very good. They're both here? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. So, Mr. Long, you would be, I believe, our last speaker on this, and we will give you 9 minutes then with the donated time, sir.
Thank you, President Pauley and board. First and foremost, thank God for the rain, right? We know this doesn't get us out of years of drought and certainly doesn't get us out of the probable future droughts, but thank God for what we got today. Alan Long, as President Pauley mentioned, a lifelong resident of Murrieta and Temecula. Now, I know that may look like it's only 30 years, but it's actually 53. So I've been there a long time. Yeah, that's a joke. Thanks. 17 years I've served on city commissions and boards, both appointed and elected, 2 terms on council and mayor. Recently just retired out of the fire service, served 36 years, started my career as a volunteer, Murrieta Fire, and retired as a division chief for the city of Anaheim. Here today to thank you and support the project. Frankly, I've never seen anything like this. The city had numerous publicly noticed meetings on the ARPA funds, and there were a lot of competitive needs in infrastructure. We had limited money. The city had limited ARPA funds. That's a key portion because all of those potential projects were equally important, and I wished we had money for everything. I wish we had enough money to annex everyone in to the water district, but there was a limited amount of projects, and there were a lot pitched. But after hearing testimony from many residents stating they had to have their water imported, and there were in these meetings, we had a number of our residents come to each and every one of these publicly noticed meetings. And there was testimony of not being able to flush toilets, not be able to take a shower unless they all took the kids together. They had to ration water. And then there was testimony about the fires that we've had, both wild land and structure fires. And remember, I gave a testimony and exercised my expertise. And, you know, if we had fire hydrants, the small fire would have been able to be kept small. But instead it grew and grew. And to Mr. Landwehr's support, it got so big that they needed to import water. And the fire was so big it took a lot of water. It wasn't a matter of if there were water. There was water. And there always will be water because we shuttle the water in or we have air tankers drop retardant. It's a matter of when the water got there. Fire hydrants would have kept a small fire small. The city listened to us. And I tell you, this is a great example. There's a lot of examples of bad government, and we all complain about the bureaucracy. This is a perfect example of the city listening to the residents they serve, and then EMWD took it a whole nother level. Not only did you accept the money, you said, hey, we got some ideas too. How can we help? And you created a mechanism for people that are strapped financially in some cases, a finance mechanism to connect to the water source. I wish I had that opportunity when I annexed in a while ago. I had to pay the whole thing. That was phenomenal. I've never seen this level of cooperation and government working together for what the people ask for. It's phenomenal. So thank you. Thank you for that. Not to be left out, the public noticing and the involvement from both the city and the water district was second to none. Roxanne Roundtree, I didn't see her here today. She was phenomenal in the level of outreach that she did. My neighbors all were informed. In fact, I went door to door because my fear was this was such a unique opportunity that a neighbor may not know about it. You know, when they weren't at the meeting, I went to their door. I went around. We had a neighborhood meeting, and all the neighbors were involved. In fact, I saw Roxanne Roundtree going door to door by foot. I thought I was the only one who did that. And she equally thought it was important, was worried that not everyone would know about these meetings. So I want to thank you for that. You know, a couple other things were said. I've lived there a long time. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but 53 years in that area, and I've never seen a flash flood. It may have happened, but I've never seen a flash flood. But what I can tell you is there are operational procedures, because that is a concern. Runoff is always a concern, especially in my career as a fire service. We deal with sometimes hazardous materials, and we have operational procedures for those emergency situations where we dike. There's hazardous materials. We assume there's hazardous materials in house fires. We dike. We control the runoff. So there is mitigation measures in place for those emergency situations. Finally, the land map USAC, because you're here to hear about the project and provide CEQA. You know, there's a public right-of-way where all of these water lines are going for, and thank God for the Public Land Use Map Act that gives permission through public right-of-way for infrastructure, and that's really what you're doing here. And again, I want to thank you as a board, working with the city on both sides here to making this even possible for our area, which is much needed. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the comments. Are there any further questions for staff or Director Corona? I know you just got here. Any questions on this item?
No, I don't have any questions. You know, I attended a number of the meetings myself, and I think that it's great for the residents to be able to come out and see what was being presented by Eastern and the city of Murrieta, and so I think this is a good thing for everybody.
So. Your area, would you like to make the motion on the item?
I would make the motion.
I'm sorry, Director Slauson.
I'm just going to make a comment.
Okay.
The issue of the fire hydrants, the potential for flooding, I've never seen that brought up. It's sort of a novel argument. But I've seen the opposite, where fire hydrants, for instance, with insurance companies, provide you a lower insurance rate. It mitigates for potential fire hazards. And I've never seen an issue about water in the case somebody hits a fire hydrant. You know, fire hydrants are all over our cities and counties, next to buildings, and the potential for it's rare that it would cause any sort of damage. So I don't see that as an issue. And as far as the hydrant spacing, in the final design, that will, you know, we have a spacing requirement. Fire department has a spacing requirement, and it helped to protect homes. So I think it's a great project, and I support it. I'll second it.
All right. So we have a motion by Director Corona, a second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Can I make a comment as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Okay. I just wanted to follow up. I think I have my career in public agencies, and to see this level of cooperation, I think, is an example of how government should work. And not only that, even though I know that there might be some concerns about how fast this moves along through some of the processes, this is moving really fast for government agencies. I think it's a great example. And, you know, there's 36 of the 50 property owners have signed a financing agreement. That's 72% of the property owners that at least support this project enough to sign a financing agreement. So I think this is a great project. It's a great example of working together, and I think it's going to be a great benefit to the community. So aye.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Apologize. Just to let you make a comment there. That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. With that, we will go back to item 3, which is our consent calendar. Are there any members of the board that have additional questions on the consent calendar? Would like to pull an item for separate discussion.
Okay.
Is,
A.
I will abstain on.
C.
Okay, so Director Slauson has a conflict. To state the conflict on item K?
Conflict is I've done work for Hillwood Development, which is the property developer.
Very good.
Would you like me to make a motion on the remaining items?
If nobody else has a question or like to pull an item, yes, you may make the motion on the...
I'll move the consent calendar.
Director Armstrong, would you like to second the consent calendar? Motion by Director Slauson, second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0, except for item K, with Director Record absent. I will note that Director Slauson has left the dais.
I'll move K.
Director Crona moves K. I will second item K. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 3-0 with Director Slauson not participating and Director Record absent. With that, we will go back to our action calendar and we will do 4A, which is to adopt a proposed resolution of issuance of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District acting as the legislative body of Community Facilities District number 2017-77, Improvement Area B, authorizing issuance of its 2023 special tax bonds and approving bond documents. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. As you mentioned, this is related to a bond issuance for CFD number 2017-77, Improvement Area B. Oops, went a little too forward. I'm excited here.
Hi.
The CFD was formed in 2017. There were two improvement areas, A and B, that were part of the CFD. The next year in 2018, some change proceedings were presented where Paris Union High School District improvements were added as authorized facilities to be funded. The CFD was authorized to issue $8 million in bonds secured by special tax revenues of the residents in this community. And the CFD is located just near the city of Menifee in an unincorporated area of Riverside County, just about a block west of Liberty High School. On a Saturday, dropping off my daughter to cheer practice on Saturday, we drove by the community just to make sure things were on the up and up and was able to snap this picture. Notably, you see Idlewild in the background. This picture was taken before all the heavy rainfall we've had recently. CFD was formed with a master developer, Global Investment Pool, LLC. The property for this improvement area was acquired by Richmond American in 2020. This improvement area was planned for 250 homes. I have information here related to January 17th information. We've actually received updated information earlier this month, and I'm happy to report that 177 homes have now been conveyed to homeowners, and Richmond American just owns the 73 homes with 12 of those in escrow. Due to the amount of homes that Richmond American owns, it results in 29% of the special tax. And per our debt policy, requires an LOC to be posted if any property owner owns more than 20% of the special tax. The LOC calculation for this for Richmond American was $199,000, which we received this week. Once their percentage owned falls below the 20%, then the funds will be released back to the developer. As noted on the bottom of this slide, the last bullet, we did not pursue having an appraisal be conducted on this property, mainly due to the assessed value we received from the county, along with home sales information from the developer. The aggregated value, or the calculated aggregate value, was $112 million. Based on this, the value to lien ratio came in at 11 to 1, which exceeds our debt policy requirements. Delinquency levels, 2.25%, which is under our 5% requirement, and then the effective tax rate just under our 2% maximum. And as I mentioned earlier, the number of lots for this is 250. Bonds in the future for this project can only be issued for refunding purposes. As a reminder, the district regularly reviews its CFD portfolio and looks for opportunities to refund CFD bonds to further lower property taxes for the affected homeowners. Projected par amount for this is estimated at just over $5 million, generating a project fund of about $4.7 million with a TIC of 4.86%. Looking at the team and schedule, the underwriter for this transaction was selected as Raymond James. If you recall, we recently priced bonds with Raymond James, and we had them assigned to this one as well, just for consistency, lining up calendars, and keeping the team consistent. Looking at schedule today, we're seeking board approval. We intend to post the POS tomorrow. We completed a due diligence call this week with the district, developer, the underwriter, and legal representation from all the parties. When it comes to bond pricing, currently shows March 30th. We are going to stick with that date. We had a team call yesterday where we reviewed a potential opportunity to price the bond sooner due to all the recent activity and movement in the financial markets. There was an initial opportunity to price bonds very competitively and favorably due to investor focus shifting towards quality credits in the bond market. We decided to stick with this deadline mainly due to next week's FOMC meeting, as Laura mentioned earlier today. It's still unsure or uncertain what the FOMC will do with interest rates, and so we don't want to price next week in competition with a volatile market. So we're going to stick with the March 30th pricing date and then close the transaction a couple weeks later on April 13th. Many members of the team are on the call today. I just want to extend appreciation for all of their work, internally staff, our municipal advisor, the underwriter, our counsel, and our special tax consultant. Today's recommendation is for the board to approve the issuance of the bonds not to exceed $6 million, approve the related documents, and authorize the general manager, the executive team, to complete all the transactions necessary to issue these bonds. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions from the board.
Any questions on this item? All right, before we vote, Thomas, I don't know if I have the authority to do this as president, but if I do, I'm going to name you the official photographer of the finance team.
Okay, I'll
take it.
Very good.
I'll let my daughter know that she's on the board since she actually took the picture.
Oh, okay. Credit where credit's due. With that, do we have a motion for this item?
I'll make the motion.
Motion by Director Armstrong, second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. We'll move on to item B, which is to approve and authorize the Santa Ana River Watershed Weather Modification Pilot Program with an appropriation of $138,000. Mr. Javier.
Yes. Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. I'll be presenting the Santa Ana River Watershed Weather Modification Pilot Program. Mark Norton is here from SAPA. He'll be here to answer any questions if I may not be able to answer them. If you recall, this item was brought to the board last year by Jeff Mosier, the GM of SAPA. As a recap, this diagram demonstrates the cloud seeding mechanism to produce additional precipitation. It utilized silver iodide, an inert chemical, that passes through a rain cloud, creating supercooled liquid water and forming the precipitation as ice crystals or snowflakes. Specifically, there is an airflow that goes over the mountain where silver iodide is introduced into that airflow as shown in the diagram as step two. The airflow is then able to reach the rain clouds where the cloud seeding occurs. The other way it's done, and most of us know of this, is through the airplane where they drop the silver iodide in there. So that's the other one. But this one's going to be cloud seeding. Cloud seeding is not new. It's utilized in the U.S. Its primary application is for hydropower, ski areas, water resource agencies, and irrigation districts. In California, there are currently 16 projects in Santa Barbara County, San Luis Obispo, and the Sacramento Municipal Water District that utilizes the cloud seeding. Now, silver iodide is safe. It is an inert mineral. It's not soluble in water. It doesn't break down to its components of silver and iodide, and it's not carcinogenic. When we utilize it in this project in the environment, the concentration is going to be close to the soil amounts that it's already existing. Mind you, this is going to be over. This is going to be spread over 500,000 acres. What we expect is it's going to be about 2 to 3 bags of, if you can think of it as a salt bag, is the amount that's going to be applied. To ensure this, trace sampling is going to be taken downstream of the areas that this is used. For cloud seeding, one of the criteria that we have is for suspension is for National Weather Services, if they issue a severe storm, precipitation, flood warning, or flash flood, this will not happen. Additionally, for target-specific areas, if the precipitation is forecast to exceed a 0.5 or 0.7 inch, or either that in a 24-hour period, the forecast is 2 to 3 inches, this will not happen. The season that the cloud seeding will occur will be from November 15th to April 15th. This is the wet season that will occur for this project. So the projection that we have for precipitation is provided here in this diagram. This is the ground-only seeding. If you look in the last two columns, it's anticipated that overall that would be about a 7.8% increase. That equates to about 8,200 in acre-feet of stream flows, and that's kind of important because that's where we'll get our ground recharge. Particularly in our area, it will be the southeast area that we will have that. The other lower portion would be if there was aerial type of cloud seeding. There are two different methods that the ground seeding that will be utilized. One's called the CNG. It's a cloud nuclei generator. Again, this is ideal for ground usage. It creates a continuous plume, and it's put right next to the mountain, so it's actually going into that airflow. It is inexpensive to install and operate. It requires propane to heat that silver iodide so it goes in the atmosphere. And then most recently, our contractor is going to modify this to be on a mobile trailer so it can be easily taken in and out. The other is what's called an AHOG. It's an automated high-output ground seeding. Again, the way this works is think of those as flares. They just operate in sequence where they go off and on. You see another on to the left of those trees, I call them, is the automated system. So they can remotely control these to go off. Those canisters are like spark arresters, so if you're worried about that flame coming out or little sparks coming out, it's contained within those items. So where this is going to be located for Eastern, we have two locations. One's called Baller Booster. The other one is Serral Tank. Baller Booster is around Homeland. Serral is just east of Diamond Valley. Overall, there are about 15 ground seeding throughout the area of where we're going to introduce this throughout SAPA's area. This diagram just shows you more details of the two locations that we're going to be where these are going to be installed. Serral Tank is located again east of Diamond Valley, and if you look from the roadway to the tank, the only thing that you can see is actually the top of the tank. So therefore, with the ground seeding equipment will not be visible from the roadway there. We have fences right at the roadway too to prevent people from going up to there, as well as Serral Tank actually has fencing around there. To the right is Baller Booster. You could see that it has a fence line in there. It's projected or it's anticipated that a block wall will actually be placed around that in the near future here. That's part of our PSPS hardening structuring program that we're going to do. Additionally, in the bottom diagram here, the picture here is just recently that occurred is the fencing that went around Baller's booster. It would be the AHOG will be actually installed outside of that block wall, but within the fence line of our property for Baller facility. So the pilot program is based on a 2020 feasibility study. It's going to occur for over 4 years. Again, the operational season will be from November 15th to April 15th. And then for the funding, we received 50% from Prop 1 round grant two, for that. So our overall participating cost for the 4 years will be $138,200. Additionally, we have an agreement. It's a three-way agreement with SAPA as well as North American Weather Consultant. This allows them, the consultant, to have access to our facilities to install the cloud seeding equipment as well as to operate that during the months of November 15th to April 15th at those two locations. During the time when they're not being operated, they'll be removed from the facilities, and the end of our agreement will be on June 30th, 2027. So staff's recommendation is to approve and authorize the execution by the general manager or his designee, the site use agreement with SAPA and North American Weather Consultant, and appropriate $138,200 for participating costs for the pilot project. And with that, I will be happy to ask your question, or Mark will.
Would you like to come up and feel free to come up and introduce yourself?
Mark is a short timer. He's planning to retire in May. So,
all right.
Good morning.
Good morning,
all members of the board. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you as well, and happy to answer any questions. I know sometimes you get sometimes odd questions. I've done about 50 presentations about this across the watershed, and trying to basically make sure the public is informed about this process. It's actually commonly used in many areas across the state and in the western United States. It was a technology that we were actually asked by our board to investigate. It's in the California Water Plan. It is called precipitation enhancement. And over the past 3 years, I've been basically working closely with our consultant, North American Weather Consultants, who did the feasibility study, and now is the operator of this four-year pilot. Our commission didn't want to jump right into an operation program, just want to make sure that we do our due diligence by doing a pilot first and then see how the results were. We also have a separate firm called the Desert Research Institute that will be doing the validation, basically confirming that we are, in fact, getting additional precipitation snowpack. That's really the focus, is snowpack. So happy to answer any questions.
I'll start with Director Slauson.
Sure. I've attended a number of those presentations, and you've gone over the safety of silver iodide and whether there have been lawsuits or environmental damage, and it all looks very good to me. But can you know, one of the things that wasn't talked about, you've met with San Bernardino and Riverside Flood Control and some arrangements?
Yes, as part of our process, we got them involved in the very beginning when we did the feasibility study. Jason Yulee, in fact, was one of our most prominent technical review committee members, many comments. We tried to be as responsive to his concerns as possible. In fact, he had mentioned that there are some areas in Romoland, Homeland, within the Easterns area that simply don't have any stormwater infrastructure when rains come, even the small ones. And he wanted to see if we could maybe think about removing one of the sites, and we did. We actually removed that site in response to his concerns. We've had many subsequent discussions with Jason Yulee. He will be part of a committee that we will have set up with the other flood control districts representatives, San Bernardino Flood Control, as well as Orange County, and our operator, North American Weather Consultants, and SAPA, to ensure that when decisions are made on upcoming storms, that they're fully informed. We also have a suspension criteria, basically, in place. And as described in the presentation, you know, there are certain size storms. We're not going to operate the program. When we know we're going to get a lot of rain, you know, these big atmospheric river Pineapple Express coming in, we won't turn on the program. We will be seeking to always reduce the risk of any type of flooding. So we're really targeting our smaller, medium-sized storms to simply add just a little. The scope and scale of this is fairly minimal in that it's typically on the 5 to 10% range of increase. So you don't see big, you know, turning points where this is going to cause flooding events. But we have also been aware that there's concern, as Jason Yulee has shared with us, about some of the burn areas from recent fires, for example, the Apple Fire. And we know that many areas recover. It's been a few years now since the Apple Fire, and we've had some good regrowth there. And so we don't think that is an issue or concern as it has in the past. There's also the Holy Fire near Lake Elsinore, and that's grown back quite well as well. But as this is a four-year program, if we do have more fires or scars, and we think there might be some more mudslides or concerns like that, we won't turn on the program in those areas. You know, we can actually pick and choose which of these seeding units we want to turn on and off. So throughout this entire 4 years, we'll be working closely with Jason Yulee and his staff and that committee of the flood control districts to make sure that we're not exacerbating any problems.
All right. Yeah, I think the project's been really well thought out and thoroughly reviewed by both Alan and Mark, so I support it.
Director Armstrong?
Yeah, I'm just curious, technically, you know, if you use it at the Searle tank and you do the seeding from there, where would you expect the precipitation to occur?
Yes. Interesting enough, when you first look at it, you think to yourself, well, why don't you just place these in the mountains? Well, we really do take advantage of the upward wind action from the seeding units, and it can be several miles away. Our target really is the mountain ranges. We really want to increase snowpack. It's not necessarily to increase precipitation in the low valley area. It is really the snowpack. And so by the snowpack, we get increased stream flow and more gradual precipitation and recharge into groundwater basins, which we really want to enhance. So there are many, many scenarios, and they do modeling now that allows the operator to know what the conditions are right to do the seeding and turn it on. And these are automated units, and they'll be able to make a judgment call as to where the wind is, where the temperatures are in the mountains, the atmospheric pressure, many conditions to make sure that they're hitting the right locations with the right seeding units. As part of the feasibility study, they looked at many of these scenarios. And that modeling effort as well is going to be used by also the meteorologists to help them real time with the evaluation of where these plumes would actually be hitting the mountain areas. So it's a lot of sophistication, a lot of experience that we are relying on with North American Weather Consultants. They've been doing this for over 40 years. They're one of the most experienced firms out there. Programs in multiple places in California, including the two locations in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, and multiple locations in Colorado and Utah. So that's the intent, is really to focus in the mountains there.
So even if it's at that specific location, you don't expect that's where it's going to occur. Rather, it's going to be whatever the weather and the wind and atmosphere is moving towards the mountains.
Correct, yeah. There's also sometimes we hear concerns about adjoining watersheds. Are you going to be taking water away from them? The reality of this type of program is simply adds. It actually might benefit adjoining folks to the east, some in the Coachella Valley, that might actually see some benefit. But it's not substantial. You know, we're really looking on the upside of the mountains there that was the target.
Director Corona?
Well, I'm happy to see that you're not taking advantage of any thunderstorm activity, which would be bad for onions, bad for grapes. You know, we don't want those type of rainstorms or anything else during harvest time. But I think it's kind of exciting. I'd like to see how it works out. So
my question is, normally when you shoot things into the atmosphere, the South Coast Air Quality Management District doesn't get all that excited about it. Where do they stand on this?
Well, I appreciate that question. It's certainly something to look at. First of all, we don't shoot anything. It simply is burned, and by wind action, it floats into the mountains.
You're still putting particulates into the air, which
moving
into
particulates. And as part of CEQA, we are required to make sure that we're in full compliance with the Southern California Air Quality Management Board. And these levels are at levels that are so low that they really don't have any negative impact. It's insignificant impact. So that was evaluated as part of our CEQA, and it's listed in there. So there's no additional mitigation that has to be done associated with the amount of particulate that's being added. We know that particulates are being added everywhere all the time by exhaust from diesel vehicles all across, as well as regular vehicles all across Southern California. The amount is very minimal. Someone, actually our operator said, you know, the scale of the amount of particulates that are being added is probably from one unit over one season is about the same as one diesel vehicle running around in Southern California. It is simply insignificant in comparison to the background that's out there.
Okay. I don't know enough about this, and just learning, I kind of feel for myself if we're spending $138,000 on something, I'd rather see it be spent towards capturing and storing water that Mother Nature has put on us. So I will probably abstain from this vote. But if we want to look for a motion and a second, motion by Director Slauson.
Second.
Second by Director Corona. Got a roll call vote, please.
President Pauly.
Abstain.
Director Corona.
Aye.
Director Slauson.
Aye.
Director Armstrong.
Aye.
That passes 3 yeses, 1 abstention, and Director Record absent. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
With that, before we go on to item 5, why don't we take about a 7 to 10 minute break?
He did listen in on the PASS agency, and he thinks, he goes,
we will reconvene our meeting. We are going to move on to the informational items this morning, with starting with item A, which is the 2022 EMD annual report. Good morning, April. And
good.
I have my, is this our copy right here?
Yes, you do.
All right.
Good morning. Just give a minute for the presentation to come up. I'm actually going to be combining items A and B together into one presentation. You do have copies of the 2022 year in review, which is our first annual report in front of you, which is what I will be focusing on first. Dramatic pause. Okay, so this is the very first annual review that we have produced. It was a brand new concept geared at really meeting our transparency and effective communication strategic goals. It highlights the priorities and accomplishments from the past year at EMWD, and it's geared to kind of clearly and effectively communicate our core services to our customers and provide them information on the improvements and investments and environmental resource management that EMWD provides. So some of the highlights in the report, it covers our core services and all the major aspects of EMWD operations, including customer service, our drought response, our water use efficiency advocacy, community engagement. It takes basically the best of some of our larger documents, our budget, our annual financial report, our water quality report, and our annual ledge report into one simpler format for an easy read. The main method of distribution for this report will be via website, email, and social media. However, we will also be sending hard copies to our stakeholders, our legislators, our delegates, cities, and other partner agencies. And I definitely wanted to give kudos to our communications team, which is Joyce, Kevin, and Aaron. A few of them are in the room right now, for putting this concept together and certainly for making it so beautiful and easy to read. Then moving on to our strategic communications master plan, this is looking ahead to what we're going to focus on for outreach in 2023. And as usual, the purpose is to align with our strategic communications priorities, increase awareness for our customers and stakeholders, increase engagement with them across different platforms, reinforce our transparency and trust so that they have the information they need, and really work on building some relationships and partnerships and continue to position EMWD as the industry-leading resource. So our key initiatives for this year include customer service. Our main priority is going to be actually focusing on a customer communications preferences campaign, which will include a survey of our customers to find out where it is that they want to receive their information. How do they want to interact with us so that we can truly target our outreach in the way that works for them and make them engaged in the process. Also, water use efficiency, obviously, as conditions continue to evolve on a regular basis year to year, we will keep our focus on water supply awareness, but also really increasing our water use efficiency in our Landscapes for Living program. For our education outreach, which is a huge component here with 11 school districts in the area, we are going to be taking a pause and suspend all of our programs starting this summer through the end of the year. We're going to engage in a whole new program development and draft a plan that is really intended to incorporate new partnerships and career building steps so that we are actually focused on teaching our youngest customers not only about our services, but then what career paths are available to them through this industry. Latino outreach is also a focus for this year. Focus heavily on tap water safety and the utilization of our mobile hydration station, which is very popular, and then groundwater reliability plus, and the big focus on our next large project, which is purified water replenishment. And then internally, we're also going to be focused on outreach for our internal stakeholders and our best ambassadors to our external stakeholders, which are our employees. And we're focused on our safety culture here, as well as workforce development and succession planning that is what HR is embarking on. Key communication strategies to do all of that, our digital media. We are engaging in a website redesign, which next month we will be bringing forward an item to look at that project. And part of digital outreach also includes social media, obviously, but we're going to really engage in targeted advertising. So we're going to look at some research and data and utilize that information to be able to provide some targeted social media outreach. Proactive media briefings, the internal pipeline, our internal website, that's going to be part of the full web design process. And then our education program, as I mentioned, we will be developing a full new program for that. And, of course, Latina outreach is really going to be focused on targeting the media. The Latino culture focuses heavily on broadcast, so we're going to work to engage in that arena with them to broaden our outreach in that demographic. For evaluating our efforts throughout the year, we'll continue to look at our digital traffic. We track all of our social media platforms, our website statistics. We work with customer service to find out what calls are coming into customer service and what the main topics are so that we know what our customers are asking about. Media tracking, we track not only our outreach but the coverage that we're getting. Obviously, if we're hosting events, we keep track of who's attending, how many, and what we're targeting. And then, as I mentioned before, the customer communication preference survey is the big focus this year to get a real good handle on how our customers want to engage with us and how we can make our outreach most effective and efficient. And then part of the strategic communications master plan includes what we call our outreach timeline. It's the appendix in the back of the report. That really provides our roadmap for the things that we're going to do throughout the year. It's a working document, and I wanted to give a big thank you ahead of time to all of the PGA staff because it could not be accomplished without all of them. So they are essential for accomplishing the plan throughout the year. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions?
Just a comment.
Oh, yes. Go ahead,
can I make
please.
A comment? Yes. Want to make a comment. I mean, this is really good. And I just want to compliment the whole PGA team. You guys do a fantastic job in all the areas that you guys are out there making a difference. And I just think you do a great job. So thanks.
Thank you. And thank the team that's here today.
No, I just wanted to say kudos again to you and your team and the department you lead. We heard it earlier today. You know, rarely do we have public comment where people are praising EMWD employees, and I know in Roxanne's case it's well warranted, but to hear that to go on above and beyond and walking neighborhoods and knocking on doors, it really is the culture that you lead in your department that is just amazing to me. So I'm glad we're doing more things. I think I mentioned admin committee. I'd love to see a copy of this go to all our legislators and other, maybe other government officials in the water space, just because it looks great. And it has a lot of good digestible information in it. I was looking at it after the admin committee and was very impressed. But on the Latino outreach, I agree with you. I would love to, at some point when you have the Telemundos of the world, that when there are rain events or water events, that they kind of know that Eastern's the place to go, not only because we have people in your department that are bilingual, but I think keeping, as that's a growing segment of our population, it's really important to me that we are constantly outreaching, communicating to people in the language they understand. So I look forward to seeing more of that.
Sounds good. Agreed.
So with this, and again, I know you have folks back there, and I want to just thank everyone for the work you do here, because it is the public face of EMWD, and it's very important that we have a public face that is well-respected out in the community, and I know we have that. So thank you very much, April.
Thank you.
All right. We will go on to item C, which is our financial operating and capital highlights for the second quarter. Mr. Adams.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Wait for the PowerPoint to come up. This morning, I'm going to provide as President Pauly said, an update on our second quarter financial highlights and our capital improvement program. I am tag teaming this with Linnea, who will cover the capital improvement program and update there. Just quickly, let me make sure this is working. This is our second quarter, so this is what we consider mid-year. So this is including a little more detail on the capital. And then really at the end, I'm going to talk briefly about the projections for the remainder of the year and talk about the trends that we're seeing related to both expenses and revenues. So this is our standard agenda for the presentation. I'm going to quickly go over the consolidated enterprise and look into the different operating areas, specifically water, wastewater, recycled water. Linnea will cover the capital improvement program, give you a great update on progress this year so far, and then I'll go into the projections for the remainder of the year, and then cover or finalize it with a quick summary. So at the consolidated level, really at the high level, budget overall for revenues is 5.3% higher than budget, and expenses are just a little over 10% under budget. When you look a little closer, operating revenues are just 1.4% below, so very tight on the operating side, but operating expenses are 10% under. Really what's driving the revenues is the non-operating expenses. Not new. Certainly connection fees have been a large component of that. Currently almost $10 million over budget based on those connections. I do have some projections I'll show later in the presentation. The other thing I want to highlight is the late fees. Late fees are higher than we had initially projected for this year, already $1.1 million over the budget. So moving down, debt service, 13%. Again, conservative estimates, I think. On the variable rate, we anticipate a 3% is our conservative estimate. The variable rate has been performing a lot better than that 3%. Just to note that the pension UAL was paid in the first quarter, so the full $15 million was paid in the trust. In general, based on progress in both OFA and capital, we are under budget, which just means that we're using less reserves. And so certainly the net operating margin was higher than budget. That does help offset those capital outlays. So quickly in water service, overall sales is just below budget. You see that 1,800 acre feet. Revenue is only 2.1% under budget. So sales, 3.6, but revenue is only 2.1. Looking at operating expenses, $9 million under or 10% below budget. Overall in sales, you look at domestic, under budget, you know, people conserving, other factors as far as impacting on domestic sales. Ag, really, that's driven by purchases by Lake Hemet Water District. Overall, purchase water costs are down. Part of that is with the less sales, but the other thing is the operational shift that has occurred in which we're using more untreated water. So that's reducing our costs, at least on the purchase water side. And just quickly on these, this slide just showing the numbers. Overall, water revenues, again, 2.1 under, and just slightly under prior year if you look at that point too. So certainly sales were less this year, but just slightly you know, under sales from at least revenues from last year. You see the 10% under budget. I do, you know, highlight that 2.5% above prior year actual. So, you know, expenses are going up, but, you know, when you compare year over year, only 2.5%. Jumping into wastewater, flows were higher than what we budgeted, but are very consistent in comparison to the prior quarter. Wastewater revenue is a lot tighter, only 0.4% below budget. But you look at operating cost, almost 10% below. So very consistent there as well. And, you know, as you'll see later in the presentation, that's really, those areas are really based on labor. That's really what's driving those operating costs under budget. Treatment cost, just $1.4 million lower. Again, labor is really driving that. Energy costs are higher, you know, 7.8%, but only $300,000. Same thing with chemicals. 47% higher than prior year, 19% higher than budget. Ultimately, that's, you know, less than around a half a million dollars. And here you see the 0.4% under budget and the 9% under budget on expenses, but really focusing on prior year, 2.8% above prior year revenues and 6% higher than prior year. So really some of those cost increases, whether it's, you know, chemicals, treatment, a little higher than prior year. Recycled water, above budget, but very similar to prior year. Revenue is in line with the current projection, so very tight there. Overall operating expenses, 9% below budget, very similar to the other two. You know, just some key variances. Natural gas, 18% higher. We all are aware of the increases that happened in the second quarter. And then transmission expenses, this is really just some unplanned repairs that occurred. Recycled water isn't a big operation, so it doesn't take much to have some impacts on where their operating expenses are. So you see the numbers, just less than 1% under budget on revenues, but 5.8% less than prior year. Last year certainly wasn't as wet as December, as we've seen this past year. A little more sales last year and a little more revenue. Operating expenses 9% under, but 8.7% above prior year. So jumping quickly into reserves, reserves $661 million. This is the breakout between restricted and unrestricted. But, you know, certainly an increase from the first quarter. That's pretty common. Debt service we have in September, we also made the $15 million pension payment. So that did draw down reserves. I usually go and look just year over year. So 661 in comparison to the 643 in 2021. Roughly an $18 million change. Again, I think you'll see we have some savings that's occurring in labor and also in some of our capital outlay that's occurring right now. So connections, these are projections as of January. I actually did get February numbers, which actually look on the water side better than January did, if you can imagine that. So February was stronger than January, but just really looking year, you know, for the year, sewer is just 2% less than it was last year. So really tracking very similar. Last year was one of our highest years. It is 62% above budget. Water, 27% less than prior year, but still 12% higher than what the budget is. And if you recall, the budget is really our 10-year average. So operating fixed assets, we've been talking about this multiple quarters, just, you know, sort of impacts on the supply chain and our ability to get and to spend money on assets, you know, like vehicles. And certainly, I mentioned it last quarter, All our vehicle orders have been placed. We're still just waiting on those in order to make payments. And so you certainly see year-to-date spend is 9%. We're, you know, hoping to, you know, improve that as we get to the fourth quarter. But overall, just, you know, really lower than we had projected. And again, a lot of supply chain issues and impacts and delays. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Linnea to provide an update on the capital improvement program.
Thanks, John, and good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. The first slide provides you an overview by service and program for our capital improvement program, but I'll go into some specific details on the following slides. First of all, for our five-year CIP, thinking about our five-year CIP as year one being fiscal year 2022-2023, we established a five-year budget of $690 million with an assumed estimated external funding of $123 million. However, as conditions have evolved in our year one for 2022-2023 that I'll expand on in a couple of slides, our current targeted expenditures for this five-year period is $667 million. As with the last couple of years, our water system investments are showing as our highest expenditures, averaging at $104 million per year over the five-year period. For the current fiscal year, again, water making up the majority of our CIP, and of our 345 projects currently in our CIP, the majority of the expenditures are in the construction phase of the program or project implementation. This slide shows what I was referring to in the beginning of the presentation, where our actuals for the current fiscal year compared to our original estimated five-year CIP are showing a little bit lower than what we originally estimated. When we locked in our five-year CIP, we assumed a $129 million expenditure rate for this first fiscal year. However, after looking at the timing of bidding some of our very large construction projects, we wanted to make sure that we spaced those out. Last board meeting, you approved a large, about a $30 million construction job on our wastewater CIP. About a month before that, there was a $20 million award for a wastewater project. We currently have out on the street our large Paris North centralized treatment project. So in order to space these out and to maximize competition for bidding, some of these are the expenditures are shifting out of year one, which is why our new projected is now $105 million compared to the $129 we originally locked in. So far, our top five expenditures for the Q2 of this fiscal year equate to about $26 million, and you can see the examples of those projects listed here. We also completed several projects in the construction phase for this quarter. The total project cost that is shown here, the $129 million, that's the total for those projects. It's not what we expended in this quarter, just to be clear. But we did complete 14 projects that were in the construction phase. We've also continued to see a lot of volatility in the market, as this slide shows, in terms of the bids that we received in this quarter reporting period. I think we've gotten very lucky. Total, we're about 1% off low compared to our engineer's estimate. But in reality, we're seeing some here that are negative 22%. Negative 36%, others that are plus 10%. So again, this just further reinforces that there's still a lot of volatility in the market, and our consultants and our engineers are still trying to navigate how best to estimate the uncertainties in the market. The next several slides show examples of projects that align with our strategic priorities, water supply diversity and reliability. A couple of projects here are Getz Road Tank that's currently in design, our San Jacinto raw water pipeline that's in construction. On water recycling, we're continuing to advance our French Valley Recycled Water Pipeline Phase 2 project that's currently in construction. And as was previously mentioned, we are in design for our purified water replenishment project. We continue to advance our salinity management program. We did complete and close out our Paris 2 desalter in this quarter, and we also continue to work with the Army Corps of Engineers to further expand that program through the Valley Boulevard brackish water pipeline that's currently in design, as well as identifying additional wells to support the overall program. Protection of public health and environmental health continues to be an important aspect of our CIP program. We are, as I mentioned, we are currently out to bid with the largest element of our North Paris groundwater contamination program and hope to be in construction with that in the next couple of months. And we are still advancing the Quail Valley sub-area 4 sewer with currently being in the preliminary design and CEQA of that project. We are doing various projects in the planning phase to, again, further position ourselves for improved reliability and environmental considerations. Although the solar phase 3 is still shown on here, the construction is complete, and we are capitalizing on that program now. However, we have some contractual elements that we're still finalizing, and so project closeout is expected later this year. We're also continuing to advance our Lake Skinner transmission system and EM11 connection, again, to further enhance system reliability into the future. We've had several accomplishments in the CIP this quarter, including securing an additional $12 million in Prop 1 funding for our Paris North program. We began construction on the Phase 2 pipeline for that program and also completed the final design of the treatment plant. We achieved substantial completion on the Murrieta Road Transmission Pipeline Phase 1 and kicked off the design of all of our ARPA-funded projects. We also secured an additional $27.5 million in Bureau of Reclamation funding for our purified water replenishment program, as well as completed the 60% design as we continue to advance that program. We achieved substantial completion on the eucalyptus booster station and also gained support and approval from the State Water Resources Control Board to advance into the next phase for our Quail Valley Subarea 4 sewer project. And with that, I'll take any questions before I turn it back over to John.
It's a lot going on.
Yes.
That's my one comment.
I was hoping you were going to ask her difficult questions.
And I'm saving those for you.
Yeah. It's easy to, on all those accomplishments, it's an easy way to end. As I mentioned earlier, this is the second quarter. So we did take a look at how we did in the first two quarters and really look at projections going out based on our current trends. So first area I want to talk about is wages and benefits. Certainly with the higher COLA than we had planned, that does have an impact. But when you look overall based on our vacancies, health insurance and other benefits, you see certainly we're projected to be less by the end of the year. Right now, that projection is 7.6 million or 6.6%, but certainly that is what's really impacting a lot of the service areas as far as operating costs being under budget. Next, just looking directly at water and wastewater and recycled water. So one of the things we do, we took out labor. We also take out allocated costs. And so these are really those direct costs within those service areas. So overall, when you look at water, right now we're projecting about 3% based on the first 2 months of the year over budget. Now, remember, we did make adjustments to the budget back in mid-year, May and June. So 3% higher, at least on the water. Wastewater, you see the 4%. Just the notes, certainly on water, I mentioned the less in purchased water, chemical increases based on that operational shift and costs there. Wastewater, certainly the energy, chemicals, and waste hauling, we've seen increases in that area in the recycled water, which is really due to the energy component. So when we look at major operating expense categories, and these are really the three I talked about on the prior slide, but really just to show you what those increases are overall district-wide. So chemicals 6% higher, higher rate increases than planned, and also the untreated water. Electricity 22%, a little bit of the delay on phase 3 and the impacts and benefits that we get from that. but just also just the shifts and the increase in energy there. And the natural gas, I do, you know, highlight that one, 30% under. This really goes to operations and how they change using of natural gas, using electricity during that high period of time. So really that savings is based on operations making changes in the way that they're managing the plants. And then finally, waste hauling, 3% over, just higher rates. And I think we've had discussions on those going back to, you know, last 12 months. So with that, the summary is, you know, certainly overall operating revenues, just 1.4% under target. You know, that's very good, you know, as far as, yeah, it's not over, but it's very close to on target. Operating expenses really driven by labor are 10% under. I highlighted the water, wastewater, recycled water connection fees, again, higher, and this has been a theme over the last couple years. You know, Linnea mentioned the $4.7 million in CIP expenditures. We do a great job in outside funding, about $5 million offset that cost. And then just in general, you know, we're doing good. I think at least where we're forecasting now, we will, you know, end the year pretty strong. So with that, I'm available for any questions.
Any questions?
No questions.
I had one on, go back to the late fees. It was $1.1 million that we collected in late fees this, did I hear that right, or?
Yeah, well, no, it's $1.1 million above what we were projecting.
Oh, above what we were projecting.
So this is off the top of my head. I have lots of numbers in my head.
Okay. I know you do.
I think the number that we had was in the $4 million range for the year.
Okay.
And I think it was 4.5. So half of the year would be 2.2 million. I think what we collected was 3.4 million one over. You know, traditionally prior to the pandemic, that late fee number was in the 5 million. So, and it's gone as high as 6 million in the past.
So John, just to confirm what you said on slide four, maybe we can go back to that. Wait, yeah, he shows late fees to date, as of end of second quarter, is $3.4 million, of which $1.1 million
over budget.
Is over budget.
So the budget for the first 6 months, $2.2 million.
Correct.
Or $2.25 million.
So we, and Laura, feel free to jump in. I attribute this. We trying to get back on what our late fees would be coming out of the pandemic, and the fact that we weren't able to charge them. We're kind of readjusting our calculations on what we're going to bring in every so often on late fees, correct?
Yes, I appreciate the board's approval to bring them back. I think it was in the fall of 2021. Yeah. And so this will be the first full year of late fees. Mm-hmm. So we are appreciative of that. I think it's really helped our accounts receivable aging, and we'll continue to push forward on it.
Okay. No, I just that's something I'm very – to me, a late fee – is a way of honoring those that pay their bills on time. And that's, you know, I'm not here to make it punitive or whatever, but I want to honor those that pay their water bills on time. And by charging a late fee for those that don't, I think that's acceptable. I just want to make, I'm just always curious of where that number is going and how we calculate it. And
President Pauly, there are real administrative costs that this organization bears when it comes to late payments. So we need to recover those administrative costs.
And I will just say there were other agencies that waited. I mean, they didn't pursue this until a year and a half later. And their accounts receivables does not look pretty. So I appreciate that we were able to kind of get it going and lower that balance we had.
Okay. Very good. I have no other questions. So thank you very much for that presentation.
And President Pauly, if I can add, I think we wanted – this actually flows very well, because this mid-year update provides the board with updated information relative to how we're doing in this current fiscal year and as John pointed out, fiscal projections for the end of the year. So it does appear that we're going to end the year close to target, if not in a better position than we anticipated. We are seeing higher than expected expenses, as John and Laura and others have pointed out in the past, whether it's chemicals or energy or other expenditures that are coming in above target. But traditionally, we've also budget conservatively, and I think that's helped us during this fiscal year. But I think this presentation, this information is a really good basis to have the next conversation that we want to have this morning with the board, which is the cost of service study that you've been briefed on several times before, but we're at a point where we are going to be presenting recommendations today as far as a path forward. We want to get the board's feedback. We want to get your input, your perspective. We will plan on having, and John will go through the details, one more study session, but we are at a point where we're nearing the time when we're going to have to make decisions as far as the Prop 218 process. So we definitely, as John and Laura, and we have our consultant Mark Penny on the line as well, as we go through this, I, for one, I'm definitely interested in the board's feedback and perspective on our recommendation going forward.
All right. Well, let's get into it then.
All right. Thank you, Joe. As Joe mentioned, this is study session number 4 with the board to give you an update on the 2023 cost of service study and rates. We do, as Joe mentioned, have some preliminary results and even preliminary recommendation on rate increases. As Joe mentioned, our consultant with Corolla, Mark Panny, is on the line. He recently had his first child between our last meeting in January 18th and now. He has a newly born son. Roger is his name. But so Mark is certainly daddy duty in keeping him as close as possible to his new son and his wife to help her out. He does plan to be here in person at the April meeting to do the final recommendation and present the final report to the board. So I know he wishes he was here, but with the new kid, I'm sure he's more happy to be there. So
very understandable.
All right, let me... I was on a roll there for a second. All right. I apologize. So today, this is the presentation agenda. I'm gonna open it up. I'm going to cover the first few slides and really talk about the goals and provide you an update on where we stand, talk about some of the key considerations. I think when we go into a rate study like this, there are some goals that you're looking to set and things that you're considering as you're trying to make a recommendation that makes sense to the board as we talk about going forward with rate increases. I'm going to talk briefly on the revenue requirements. I'm going to talk about our reserves. I know I briefly highlighted those reserves earlier in this in the second quarter presentation, but I want to talk about the reserves that we have, with the reserves that are available related to our CIP and our rates. So I'm going to spend some time there. And then I'm going to turn it over to Mark. Mark is really going to walk through updates on both water and sewer, really cover the cost of service allocation, the methodology, and then talk about some of the individual rate results that I think you got a chance to see in January. We have updates, made some changes in allocations and methodology, and then cover the phase-in on the postage stamp, and then he's going to present really the bill, at least the preliminary results, those rates, those impacts on a traditional residential customer. What's a little different for this, we're going to show all 5 service areas. I think it's going to be important, as you see with the sewer phase-in, what those impacts are, because percentage increases are a little bit different, a couple, 3-4 tenths of a percent between the 5 service areas. And then I'll jump in at the end and talk about next steps and timeline. Yeah. All right. So just quickly, goals. It's to provide the board really an update, talk about the update the updated rates based on new information. We do have a multi-year rate plan. Usually when we adopt rates, it's in 2-year increments. Usually when we do the cost of service study, it usually projects out rates for 5 to 6 years. So we want to show you those projections for the multi-years going out 5 to 6 years. Want to cover briefly the postage stamp, talk about what that looks like over the 7 years and the impacts, provide you the preliminary bill impacts, and then really what Joe mentioned, really get feedback from the board. I think we really appreciate the questions and the feedback and the direction to make sure that we're on target with the expectations of the board. As far as, updates since last study session, it's been almost 2 months. When we came to you in January, it used the 22-23 budget, the adjusted budget as our baseline for going into 24 and 25. What we now have are those new projections based on department submittals with updated cost increases that were submitted in February. So the new rate model has those projections that departments have provided us. It also refreshes the cost allocation based on those new budgets. We're also using updated sales and revenue numbers. We talked about our mid-year analysis at the second quarter. We've updated those revenue projections and sales accordingly. And then with the updated information, we have updates to the reserve balances. Oops. God. All right. Okay, now I'm on. So going into the rate model, really thinking of the key considerations, and I'll go through each one of these, is, you know, of course we want to set rates that maintain our strong financial position. When we talk about our AAA rating, the healthy reserves that we do have, certainly we want to set rates that continue us on that straight path. Also take advantage and incorporate operational efficiencies, you know, from a perspective of setting rates to be able to fund innovation and new technologies and really improve the way that we operate, another key consideration. I just thinking about the two-year budget that's coming up, operational efficiency, I mean, we're recommending a reduction in staffing, and that's unusual when you're a growing agency. So, you know, we're only able to achieve that based on implementing operational efficiencies. Moving on, investment in water and sewer infrastructure. Linnea mentioned the $33 million investment in San Jacinto Reclamation Facility. That's a rehab project. The rate consideration and the rate plan continues to make those investments. Let me take a break. When I look at water supply, development of local resources for resiliency, Linnea mentioned North Paris, another great example. The rate plan does include funding for both North Paris and PWR. And then just jumping down to inflation, we've seen unprecedented cost increases that we haven't seen in 40 years. And so certainly last year, inflation hit a 40-year high. That is part of the consideration and really trying to how we mitigate the impacts. And then finally, reserves. I mean, we do, I'll cover reserves, but there is use of reserves, maybe more so than we have in the past. Part of that is to mitigate those impacts to ratepayers. All right, so defining revenue requirements, I'm going to just jump to the right. You know, the way we define or develop our revenue requirements is taking operating expenses, non-operating, debt, capital, and other commitments like pension and OPEB. We minus the non-rate revenue, and that becomes our revenue requirement. That is the number that we need to set rates to. That, you know, rates are going to capture that remaining revenue that we need in order to provide the service. A couple things we do, cash flow test, you know, do we have enough cash to meet our needs? And if not, do they at least cover operating and debt needs, which they will. Reserve test, you know, we really do look at our year-end balances and do they meet our minimum targets? And if so, do we have additional reserves to help mitigate rate impacts? So that's the reserve test. So just quickly on the reserve policy. First, a reserve policy really is a best practice. I mean, GFOA recommends it. Lots of agencies have reserve policies. The significance for EMWD really exhibits the stakeholders, the board's commitment to long-term financial health. It also provides stability and reliability as far as providing a certain level of service. It also supports our strong credit rating. I mean, without reserves and a reserve policy, certainly things like a AAA rating are not possible. I did highlight a couple of key policy principles. First one, provide liquidity for rates stability to ensure future rate increases are reasonable. You know, sort of key, and that's why I highlighted it in this case. And then also ensuring funding is available for future and current replacement of assets. Again, Linnea mentioned a couple, two projects. Without those reserves, we would not be able to do those projects. And then finally, you know, provide the district financial flexibility for unanticipated costs, in which we have seen a lot of those cost increases over the past 2 years. God damn, All right. So getting into reserves, from an accounting or from a GAAP perspective, there's really two categories. One is restricted and the other one is unrestricted, but board designated. So the first group, restricted, available for really narrowly defined purposes. And, you know, I highlighted two of our restricted funds, connection fees, which are really restricted to buying capacity within our system. And then the second one, which is our bond reserve. So we'll have reserve accounts for debt. We have our GO bond reserves and revenues to pay GO bonds, which are restricted. We also have reserves for our state revolving fund loans. As far as unrestricted, this is where the board has really autonomy as far as designing and identifying reserves to be used for specific purposes. If our needs change, the board has full discretion in reallocating those reserves. So in this case, I'm highlighting our operating reserves, our operating debt service, our rate stabilization reserve, our capital betterment, rehab, and replacement, and we have three other smaller reserves. But those are really the bulk of the reserves that we have. And you know, the other reserves are only about $8 million, which I'll show on the next slide. If I go back correctly. Okay, so here's the reserve categories as of June 30th, 2022. And this is really the beginning balances that we have in the rate model. But really just highlighting the restricted at the top, we have it broken down between connection fees and debt. That's about $180 million. It's the unrestricted that will support our operations that are supported by rates. So the district does have a 90-day operating reserve. We consider this really for cash flow and emergency purposes. Our current balance is $60 million. The target is $60 million. For debt, 1 year's debt service, $30 million currently. You know, we're at the target, so the difference is zero. Rate stabilization, 30 days. $20 million at target. It's the capital betterment and the R&R that will be above target because really that's where our excess money, when you look at a surplus on an annual basis, that is the fund in which those excess funds are going into, is both capital betterment and R&R. Now, R&R, the separation happened 2 years ago when we did the new investment policy. But again, board has full discretion in those allocations. And then finally, the other reserves, general liability, workers' comp, there's an equipment reserve. But overall, $8 million is the current balance and the target. You can see on the unrestricted, our target is $274 million, but we have over $500 million as of last June. So $230 million above the minimum targets. So with that, before I pass it on to Mark, any questions? All right.
I had one. So you said the GFOA recommends reserves. Do they have a percentage just as a standard?
Yeah, it's a great question, President Pauly. Things like the operating reserve, they have between 60 and 90 days. Uh-huh. For rate stabilization, our policy is 30 days to a 60-day maximum, and that's what they recommend, a minimum of 30.
So we're mirroring best practices.
Yes, clearly, okay. Best practices. Okay. At least setting the minimums. Yes.
Okay. No, thank you for that.
Board, I would just like to add on this slide. This is the reserves that we report in our financial statements. It's the district-wide reserves that replicate water, wastewater, and recycled water. When we get into the rate study, we'll talk about how these affect each service area.
Mark, I assume you're on. Mark, we can't hear you.
Good morning. How about now?
There you go.
Perfect.
Good
Thank
morning.
You, Mark. So,
good morning.
I'll try to keep the PowerPoint going as you are going through, Mark.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Thanks for your time this morning. I think that John and Joe had a good lead in there, and just want to reiterate that this is an update from what we talked about in January, and we'll be coming back in about a month with our final recommendations for you to consider. Just want to start things off by talking about the water rates, and as you're aware, supply is the largest portion of the rates, and we wanted to outline an update to what we presented previously regarding that supply component. As you're aware, there are three different levels of supply in the rates. There's a local supply, a blended supply, and an upper tier supply. Starting with the local supply, that is comprised of groundwater and Paris II desalter production, as well as you'll see that other supply cost line. That is just a broad category for things like studies, other categories in the district's budget that support kind of all the different supplies across the board. So we have that allocated across all the supplies. That local supply, that rate component, is now projected at $1.13 for 2024. That is the portion of the rate that makes up covering the local supply costs. Moving to blended supply, and just a reminder, local supply is strictly Tier 1 residential. Blended supply covers Tier 2 residential, the Tier 1 non-residential, as well as the non-tiered non-residential customers. So that uses Paris 1 and Menifee desalters, untreated purchases from MET, as well as treatment-associated treated purchases from MET, and then some other fixed costs from MET that are spread across each unit. That rate component is now $3.07 for 2024. And then lastly, the upper tier supply, which makes up all the other tiers, tiers 3 and 4 for residential, tiers 2 and 3 for non-residential tiered, that is now $3.39. And that is strictly treated MET purchases. Focusing in on the residential tiers, we wanted to group this into three different buckets. So this kind of blends well with how the district communicates its budget-based rate structure. Starting with the household budget, that is tiers 1 and 2. The blended rate, if you look at a household using its entire budget, is going up 15 cents or 4.6% from 2023. The excessive or tier 3 rate is going up 58 cents or a 9% increase. And then lastly, the Tier 4 rate would go up 12 cents or a 1% increase. This is the result, these different percentages are the result of the cost of service process that we've discussed a little bit in the past. We took a look at the usage profile over the last several years and made updates to how infrastructure-related costs, things like storage, things like pumping, how those costs are allocated across the tiers. So that's why you see different percentages for different tiers. It's just to bring the rates in line with what we see as tying the rates back to the cost of service, which is our obligation under Prop 218. And you can see the different infrastructure components in that table, base, max day, and max hour. Base is kind of the infrastructure associated with just the day-to-day average day demand. Max day is where we start to get more into meeting that seasonal peaking behavior, and then max hours where we get into really the excess capacity that needs to be built to meet the peak day demand, and a lot of that is driven by the upper tiers. And, of course, the conservation budget is included in there as well. Focusing in on customers that are staying within budget, which, as you'll recall from previous presentations, that is the majority of your customers. Most customers do stay within budget. We wanted to look at two different households, one with a smaller budget and one with an average-sized budget. Starting with the first one, the top table, that is a 12 CCF 100 cubic foot household, or their budget, excuse me. They are using 100% of that budget at 12 CCF. Right now, their average rate is $3.23 per CCF when you blend Tier 1 and Tier 2. Under the proposed 2024 rates, what we're calculating, that would increase 4.6% to $3.38. The same is true for that 18 CCF customer, the average household budget. They're using 100% of their budget, and their average rate is also increasing by 4.6%. Keeping in mind, this is just the volumetric portion of the bill. So switching gears to non-residential, I just want to lead off by just mentioning that, and I can't recall if we've discussed this in prior presentations, but we have noticed a shift in the makeup of the non-residential class over the last 4 or 5 years. When we first developed the tiers for non-residential, it was largely to address landscape irrigation non-residential customers. But as the district has expanded its budgets for non-residential customers and increasingly included more domestic uses of water, that has shifted the demand profile. And so now you have less of that peak profile that you get with an irrigation customer and a more diverse peak profile. And so as a result, we did see some shifts in how the cost of service played out for tiers 1 through 3 for non-residential. And also as a result, non-tiered, that class, that peak profile, it has less, the peak profile there is higher than it was previously. And so some of those peak infrastructure costs are now higher for that class. I just wanted to lead off with that mention. As you look through this table and see differences compared to the 2023 rates, before we look through that. So focusing on fixed charges, the cost allocation did result in an increase of 11% in total fixed charges. The daily service charge, so that's that rate that those first two lines in the table, customer service and meter service, that increased, the two of those combined increased $1.61 per month for 2024. And the capital fixed charge component increased 60 cents per month per EMS in 2024. Total fixed charges, so when you combine all that, for 2025, the second year of our analysis, is projected to increase to increase 7%. Moving on to bill impacts, we first wanted to start with a customer who stays within their budget. So using again that 18 CCF customer, which is approximately the average customer for the district, 100% of their budget is used in this example. I just want to focus on a few lines here. The first is the figure that we've already talked about, the average dollars per CCF, the average unit cost, increasing about 4.7, and then up another 6.5 in 2025 to $3.54. You can see the increase in the daily service charge and the water capital charge on that third line from the bottom. And the total bill in this projection is increasing to $82.78, which is a 6.4% increase, and then again 6.6% in 2025. So about $5 in the first year and $5.50 in the second year. Looking at a customer that exceeds their budget, so this customer goes into both tiers 3 and 4. And their bill would increase by just over $10 in the first year and about $12 in the second year. You can see that their average unit cost is quite a bit higher than the customer that stays within their budget, and it's increasing by a higher rate as well in that first year. So 5.2% increase in the first year compared to the roughly 4.5% for the customer that stays within their budget. And then again, 6.5% in the second year, which is the same as the customer that stays within their budget. And I'll talk in a moment about that second year and the overall outlook for the financial plan. But we just wanted to start off with impacts first. So moving into some of those assumptions that we use for the financial modeling and our recommendations for just the overall revenue plan, we were really focused on, as you know, cost escalation is a major factor. Costs are increasing across the board. And so that needs to be incorporated in our rate analysis. Given the district's strong financial state We took a look at our financial modeling and made a few assumptions to best smooth out further, future rate increases, specifically for 2024 and 2025, when the impacts of that cost escalation are being felt most acutely. And just going down the list of a few assumptions, we did adjust the capital improvement plan to account for a 95% execution rate. A similar factor was added for operating fixed assets of 65% execution. We did account for a salary and benefit, essentially a vacancy of 2.5%. And then we did incorporate a drawdown of some of the district's reserves, which on the next slide I'll show the overall outlook. Essentially that the reserves were above target in our starting point, and so this analysis does account for a drawdown of that, balancing the needs of the reserves with the rate increases to try to mitigate that rate impact as much as possible, with the goal of returning to the targets within the next 5 years, and never really dipping too much below them.
Oops, sorry, Mark.
And taking a look at that five-year outlook, you can see the water share of reserves starting at about $183 million. There is a gradual drawdown to a low of about $136 by fiscal year 2027, and then we start forecasting a buildup of reserves again. And it really does keep pace with that minimum balance, that target balance throughout. We did try to keep that on target as much as possible. And you can see in this table the overall revenue increases. So we've talked a bit about bill impacts to this point, but we wanted to also talk about revenue increases because as you could see from some of those rates, some rates go up by smaller percentage, some go up by more. And the overall revenue requirement is increasing in year one by not quite 9% and then 6.5% in year two. And then we are modeling a 7% increase annually for the following 3 years. That results in a net drawdown of reserves of $39 million in the first year, the first 2 years, and then a five-year drawdown of $29 million in the full five-year forecast. Again, though, that's a drawdown to the target. So there's excess reserves above the target right now. Those are being used as a balance against rate increases into the future.
And just a few additional comments. I think when we talk about the modeling, and at least in the first 2 years, you can see we're still above target. And I think as we go into the next 2 years and really monitoring where we stand related to expenses, certainly you saw the assumptions. I think we're trying to balance that aspect of what's reasonable in the current environment. Certainly OFA 65%, we've had challenges in that area. Our execution on CIP is really good, but 5% on CIP on $150 million is $7.5 million. And so just thinking about those and being realistic on what our actual cash flow needs and what our revenue requirements are does help in what rate we're going to be charging. And by making those assumptions and reducing the actual, that revenue requirement, we're not going to be collecting more than we need and continuing to build up the revenue or the reserves that we have. I think going and looking at the third year, we'll see how we perform in the next 2 years. And, if we perform better than our projections, then that rate increase may be significantly less. If we're starting to have challenges, we can look at our budget and make adjustments to try to reduce costs. So I don't know if Joe had any.
No, I think you described it well, John. I would just add that in conversations with our team, what we realized is there are a lot of uncertainties that we're going to have to navigate through over the next couple of years. But we want it to be moderate and relatively moderate in the rate increases, meaning that that's why we are proposing use of reserves, because we did not want to automatically pass through those inflationary measures or pressures that we're seeing onto our rate customers, knowing that there are things that are going to shift over the next couple of years. So that is the rationale for using reserves, is we want to be able to calibrate over the next couple of years. And frankly, not just expenses,
But as John mentioned, there's a number of key assumptions that we've incorporated to make sure we're being very realistic. We realize, for example, on OFA, that when we order new vehicles, it takes a year and a half to 2 years to receive those vehicles because of chain of supply issues. So we realize that those costs aren't going to hit our budget immediately. That's why the 65% execution on OFA, among other things. And same thing with the CIP, we're seeing impacts on construction schedules. So we attempted to be as realistic as possible relative to expenses and budget needs going forward. And that is the rationale for not wanting to transfer all of the increased costs to our customers and shield them as we understand over the next couple of years how these expenses are actually going to materialize.
John, can you talk about the last cost of service and how we manage the outer years?
Yeah, so really the cost of service from our perspective sets the top, right, the cap of what we can justify as far as in within the legal requirements of Prop 218, what those are. But we did not, you go back and look at that cost of service, there wasn't any rates that we increased at what the cost of service showed. We made adjustments when we performed well, when we had excess reserves at the end that built our reserves. We didn't have to necessarily increase those costs. So really, from this perspective, and just that 7 and 7 is very similar to the prior cost of service study. It shows if our assumptions hold true that this would be the rate increase, but I think you can tell based on what we have done in the past, usually we're a little more conservative, and we have, you know, higher reserves at the end of the year than we did at the beginning. And so that will be adjusted when we go into the next rate setting in 2025. Director Armstrong.
Can I ask two questions yes. about this? So the OFA, the 65%, that's going to catch up in subsequent years, though, right? It can't keep it 65% every year because the prior year stuff are going to catch up. Is that
it does, but I will tell you what we're projecting is very consistent with what we've actually spent when you look at a 5 or 6 year history. Okay. So we're not that far off. And I looked at it, you know, over a 6 year period. So, you know, I don't want to say it's aggressive. It is being a little more conservative. I mean, if there wasn't a significant, I mean, going back to rate increases, I mean, we're already proposing something that is in that 6 to 7. That is significant for EMWD. Yeah. And so from that perspective, you know, assuming a higher level does have a direct impact on rates. So, okay. And with that, I think there's just a combination. You looked at salary and benefits. I mean, we only use 2.5. And, you know, there's some, I think we heard some discussions about COLAs and CPI and stuff like that. That is I think that is a conservative based on where we've seen it in the 5 to 7. I think we're, again, trying to balance some of these assumptions and stuff. So even though OFA may be a little more, I think we're a little more conservative on the labor.
Okay. And then just on the use of reserves, and I think this is what reserves should be used for to help smooth out this. But if you're using reserves, you have to stop at some point. And, you know, you got to phase out of them at some point. So are we phasing out of that during this 5-year period?
Yeah, actually, what's in, you could get into a lot of details, but certainly the first couple years on water specifically and the draw on CIP is really on Paris North, PWR. I mean, there's some higher CIP costs in the first couple years based on those water supply projects. I think Linnaeus showed you a large portion of our capital is in that area, and that does have an impact on reserves. So that it, you know, reserve usage, we're trying to smooth out it, right. But you can only do so much. The first 2 years are much higher than the outer years on the water supply side.
I should maybe clarify. Typically, the majority of our capital improvement program is funded by connection fees, meaning growth, pays for growth. What we're seeing the next couple of years, about half of our CIP is actually for refurbishment and system betterment, which is funded by the existing customers, essentially. That's unusual. We are also having to accelerate a number of projects that we brought into our 5-year CIP, frankly, because of the available funding. We want to take advantage of the funding, be it at a state or federal level. So our CIP program has increased due to that strategy. Now, what I believe that we have always done and that we want to continue to do is make those long-term generational investments for our ratepayers. Long-term, the ratepayers and the customers of EMWD are going to benefit by the fact that we are capturing a lot of that external funding. So it is a balancing approach, but as you said, Director Armstrong, this is what reserves are intended to do, is to buffer and smooth out that curve. We are, as you can see here, this is one roadmap. It doesn't mean it's the only path forward, because there are other levers that we can utilize. I personally feel that we need to get through the next couple of years, see where we're at, and then make adjustments accordingly.
Thanks.
Yeah, and Director Record, or I'm sorry, Director Armstrong, my fault. I don't have a slide to show you cash flows, and I wish I had done a slide on cash flows, but you can see that the cash flow, the first 2 years are above the cash flow, years three, four. I mean, by year three, cash flow is caught up, right. And you have, you know, from that aspect of not using reserves is projected.
Thanks.
So. And I think to add to that, we look out even further. So the next 5 years, because that fifth year, it rolls into the next year, and we've talked, had a lot of discussions with the capital group, and they do believe they're doing a lot in this five-year plan.
All right. Next we're going to jump into sewer. Mark?
Yeah. So I'll be brief on this one because I think we've discussed this a little bit at length, but one of the biggest things we've looked at with sewer is this idea of transitioning from the service area-based rates that are currently in place to a postage stamp rate that would be unified for the entire district. And to do that, we, you know, given that there are five different rates and the differences between them, we know we can't just do that just with overnight, right? And so we've been looking at phase-in to balance those competing objectives of getting revenue recovery and implementing that rate alongside mitigating the rate impacts. And so the objectives are to mitigate those rate impacts, first and foremost. We don't want customers to have rate shock. And so we've put in place a 7% ceiling on the rate, the year-over-year rate increases for any one service area. And that has been balanced with the use of reserves. That's fine, John. Thanks. So what does that postage stamp rate look like?
My fault, Mark.
That's fine. Okay. Just want to, you know, draw your attention to the two daily service charge lines. So the first one was that sixth line. Currently we're estimating that the postage stamp rate, it's an estimate because there is no postage stamp rate, of course. We're estimating that's about $33.35 per month if there was one in place. And under the modeling that we're currently doing, that would increase to $35.26. And you can see the composition of that $35.26 per month by rate component between customer service, treatment, collection, and transmission. When you include the capital charge, that would increase from currently estimated $36.99. And the capital charge, I should mention, is already a postage stamp-based rate. All customers, regardless of their service area, pay $3.64 per month per EDU. So that's already a postage stamp component. Currently, that postage stamp combined rate would be $36.99. Under this modeling, it would go to $39.75. So this is, I think, an important table that shows the seven-year phase-in. And these rates include that capital charge. So we wanted to keep the sewer daily service charge under 7% and the total, when you include the capital charge, under 8%. And you can see that in the first couple years, some service areas do increase right up to that point. And the main reason behind that is that we needed to stick to that schedule to balance the revenue forecast with getting all the sewer rate components on the same footing by the seventh year. And then at the bottom of the table, you can see that the rates that are currently on the higher end of that distribution, they would increase by a smaller percentage over those years. But by the time you get out to years 5, 6, 7, the rate increases are kind of more in line with the inflationary increases until everyone gets on the same rate. And focusing in on that first year of the phase-in, you can see the distribution of the monthly bill impacts. So most of the bill impacts, even on the higher end, are under $3 per month. I don't have the exact percentages are on that prior slide, but most of the rate increases are somewhere around $2 to $2 to $3 on a monthly basis across the service areas. Giving some context about how that compares to other agencies across the service area, across the region, the current postage stamp rate is kind of right in the middle there, kind of right on par with the average rate across the region. And you can see the five different service areas on both sides of that. So similar to water, we made a few modeling assumptions. Similarly, we assumed a 95% execution rate on capital improvement and a 65% execution on OFA, the 2.5% vacancy rate on salary and benefits. And then the sewer reserves are slightly different. So we are projecting a drawdown in the first 2 years, and a lot of that is to balance the phase-in of rates, and that drawdown is about $29 million in reserves. But throughout the full forecast, the reserves are above the target. There is a slight drawdown those first couple years, but even with that, they never dip below the target. And just looking at the next 5 years, we are modeling and recommending 6% over the next 3 years, and then 4% and 3% to close out the five-year forecast. The reserve balance actually does increase by $16 million over the full 5 years. You can see that slight drawdown, largely due to partially due to the phase-in, but then that does start building back up.
Yeah, and just going back, same, you know, capital certainly in the next 2 years is really the major portion of that drawdown on reserves. I mean, we talked about the rehab at San Jacinto, but you know, again, Joe mentioned almost 50% of the 5 year is on betterment and R&R, which is uncommon or has been uncommon in past practice. Yeah. Okay. Mark, how about if I cover these? So, just, you know, Mark mentioned the postage stamp, and really, the first thing we want to show you is what, you know, ultimately the average rate increase would be. And this is our traditional typical 18 CCF, 5/8 meter. In the first year, the overall increase $7.69, which is, ultimately a 6.7% increase. And then in the second year, it's 6.4%. And just, you know, we put down in comparison just to give you, you know, certainly related to inflation, inflation at 8.7%. So, you know, at least from that aspect, we believe these rates are certainly under inflation. If you recall, you know, last year in 2022, our rate increase was 1.8%. And in reflection of where inflation was this past January, our rate increase overall was 3.8%. Certainly from that aspect, we've been very, you know, diligent with those rate increases, but we are seeing the impacts as far as some of the cost increase. So just in comparison to other agencies, this is really showing where rates are as of January 2023. We are showing you where the 2024 estimate would be and where that lines up with other agency. This is very comparable to, you know, if you go back 2 years, prior Prop 218 notice, We're right between Rancho and Lake Hemet. And so, you know, we're certainly in that area. We're not, you know, certainly on the lower end when you look at all these agencies. I understand Rancho is going through their cost of service now and for setting rates for 2024 because they're set through 2023.
So, John, just to clarify, what's shown there for EMWD is the potentially the future rate, but the other agencies are the current rate. So the other agencies' rates may also adjust for 2024.
That's true. Yes, thank you, Joe, for that clarification. So I'm going to quickly go through the service areas. We thought with the postage stamp, really, because the percentages are a little bit different, and so we thought it'd be helpful to show every service area. So the first one, Hemet, San Jacinto, as if you remember on the prior slides on sewer, they have the lowest current as far as rates for sewer. With the phase-in, their overall rate increase is 6.9 in the first year and 6.9 in the second year. Next is Paris. Paris is actually the lowest because their sewer rate is already above the postage stamp. So ultimately, when you combine both sewer and water, their projected rate increase is 4.8% and 5%. Again, their sewer is, in some cases, almost $10 more. Looking at Moreno Valley, that's our second, as far as adjustments, second highest, 6.8, 6.8 in both years. You can see the numbers there. Sun City, 6.8, 6.8. All three of those, as you saw in the prior, are very close to each other. As far as the current sewer rates, all are, you know, have a little additional couple tenths of a percentage point to get caught up. And then Temecula Marietta, which is above those three but lower than Paris, 5.6 in the first year and 5.8 in the second year. So next steps and timeline. So currently, show you the preliminary bill impacts, get your feedback, which I think will be very important as we plan to come back to you in April in the second meeting. In April, we do have another study session, number two. We'll give you an update, specifically details on CAP, OFA, some of the real details of the budget that we've gotten in February and March that is actually included in this study. And then, mid-April, I think it's the 19th, maybe it's the 18th, but either way, we'll be providing, or at least presenting to the board, final proposed rates and hopefully authority to send out Prop 218 notices with those rate increases, or at least get direction from the board. Mid-May, we do have a final budget study session, and then we'll be back to you in June at the second meeting for the public hearing for both the budget and the rates. With that, that is our presentation, and we're open for questions, and sorry for going over lunch.
That's okay. Any questions?
I would just have a couple quick comments, and that would be that I agree with the postage rate stamp. Our system is fully operational,
integrated
one system now. It's far different from when I was first elected here. And the use of the rate stabilization fund makes sense to me. That's part of the purpose. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Director Slauson. Director Armstrong.
Just maybe when you come back to the next meeting, what I'd be curious to know, assuming you would do all the projects that some of the reserves are going to fund, not assume that we wouldn't do that, but what would the rate impact be if we weren't using reserves?
Right, so I'm going to, and Mark may have the number off. Mark, do you have the number off your top of your head or you want me to give?
You can get it later.
It's a question I made sure that Mark could answer this morning.
Did he recalculate it?
Yes. Mark?
Yeah, it's about 18% in that first year.
In the first year.
18%?
18%. So that assumes, as you said, not just projects, but 100% OFA, 100% salary, 100% everything that we're going to overperform.
So the 18%, to be clear, would be revenue increase requirements, right. not necessarily rates. Right. It's the amount of revenue we would need to increase to be able to support all the projects and all the initiatives that we are planning. But again, the use of the reserves is exactly to smooth that out, specifically for projects that are system betterment and refurbishment projects.
I guess what I'm just looking for is, like, you know, these are initiatives that you're taking to help reduce the rate impact to what the, to our customers by doing these things, using reserves, different operating plan adjustments that are being made, et cetera. It'd be nice to know, what would the bill impact percentage be if we weren't doing all of this compared to what is it?
Well, and just going to Joe's comment, I mean, his point is 100%. I mean, it's the revenue requirement. I mean, it would not have the same impact on residential. But what's even more interesting, Director Armstrong, is those rate increases in the outer years are not 7% anymore. They're based on what we project on our inflationary environment. So that second year could be 4%, you know, 4%, then 3 and 3. So you have this huge jump.
It's exactly what John is describing, what we saw. And we actually, at one iteration, we did include that slide, but we felt we wanted to focus the discussion on the what we are recommending, which is use of reserves. But to your point, Director Armstrong, what we see is a spike in the first year in terms of revenue increase that we would be needed by 18%. But as John pointed out, second year and outer years would be basically what inflation projections are, which would be 4 to 5%. It varies. But it is because of that initial spike and then the reduced level of revenue requirements that we felt it's appropriate to use reserves to smooth that out.
Yeah, I agree with all of it. I just think when you have rate increases like this, it'd be nice to be able to tell a member of the public that, hey, if it wasn't for all of these things, the rate increase would have been 12% this year instead of...
We could add it back.
Yeah.
No, I'd like to see the exact same information. I think that's very helpful that if we didn't use reserves, what would it be, percentage-wise, or, you know, maybe come up with a bill that says if we didn't do any of this? And then, do you have another comment or question?
That was it.
So the other, I just want to add in, and I'll Director Record isn't here, but he always asks this question every time we do a rate increase. What would it look like if we did nothing? What you know, not down to detail, but if we didn't take a rate increase, where would project out a couple years, what would that do to our finances here?
Well, in the model, there's actually a cash flow and shows where reserves are, but reserves would be significantly less. You know,
he always asks that, and I think it's good information because, again, the five of us have to go tell a story to the public, and, you know, why'd you just raise my rates?
Well, with showing the request by Director Armstrong, we'll show a reserve because the reserve just – drop if you don't do anything.
Yeah. I can give you, I mean, just
go into the negative.
Yeah, let me. Yeah.
I feel we have a fiduciary responsibility here to keep this agency well above, you know, any GFOA standards. But I want to make sure that we have the information. So if we didn't do this, this is what could happen to your agency. And I always say I don't want to become LADWP, where we don't do betterment and repair and reserves because we don't have the money to do it.
Yeah,
we
and
have to cut back.
Yes.
Yeah. And I, you know, I just give you ballpark. Operating revenues are $300 million, so every percent is $3 million, right? So if we're increasing at 6%, 6-7%, 18 to 21 million. But I think going back to your comment, President Pauly, if we didn't do it, we wouldn't suggest. I mean, there's only so much you can go on in reserves. We would have to change operations. We would have to delay projects and do other things, not to, you know, do those
investments. And I think, President Paul, we can show that when we come back to the board. I think, as John indicated, essentially what would happen if we did not do any rate increases is the majority of our investments in refurbishment of our system would have to be deferred. And that's, unfortunately, some other agencies have chosen that path, but that is not a good path long-term for our constituents. You know, one thing this agency has always done is making sure that our system is up to standard and we invest to make sure we're always delivering the highest quality of service to our customers. To do that, you have to make year after year investments. And some investments do benefit directly our customers, such as, for example, investments in solar energy. It's a capital cost up front, but long term, for the next 20-some years, our customers are going to benefit from those kind of investments. So there's a direct relationship between the investments we make today to the long-term benefit of our customers. But I think I hear what you're saying is, as an elected member of this board, you need to be able to explain to your constituents, if we didn't have rate increases, what would that mean to our programs? And we can show you that. We essentially, about half of our CIP would have to be looked at. That is funded by rates and reserves in this case, and we'll bring that back to the board.
I think that's an important part of the story to tell here is, you know, look, I don't think anybody on this board thinks it's just a fun day at the office to raise rates, but at some points it's a necessary thing to do. But I think having the information that said, hey, public, if we didn't do this 10, 5, 10, 15 years from now, we'd have a system where we don't have the most reliable service and we don't have the best practices in green energy, et cetera. So I don't want to get too much into the details, but I think that would be a handy part of the next presentation to have.
We can.
What we'll do.
Okay.
We
can. That's all for me. Do you have anything?
You know, I was going to say, you know, replacement parts. They if you don't keep up with it, they'll break at the most, you know, inopportune moments. So, you know, I think you really have to keep up with that. Can you bring up that yellow map with the different sewage treatment plant areas?
Yes.
Way in the beginning.
Oops. Of course, I went right by it.
Okay. So, and you... I know you've already told us this before, but the difference in the prices in there, is that due to the time or that it was built, how much improvements have been made?
Yeah, so and this is one of the slides we took out, Director Corona, to try to narrow it. But going back on history, EMWD back in the early 2000s would perform in-house rate studies. And they looked at the service areas differently because, you know, they costed rates based on those service areas. So the last rate study we did internally that was based on this service area was 2009. Since 2009, we have simply increased each of those rates based on an inflationary factor, even though over the last 15 years, those system, you know, the system has expanded. We had huge, you know, improvements in sewer. They're all connected. You know, when you talk about operations, I mean, we showed treatment costs of 70%. Each of the treatment plants are, you know, treating it the same way, and the costs are very similar. But it really is just legacy that at one point those plants were singularly independent. Costs were calculated based on those costs that were occurring back in the 2000s and was simply increased by inflation for the past 12 years. It's not reflective of the current costs and operations. And a good example is Sun City, which is the Menifee Sun City. Paris Valley treatment plant treats all of that sewer. But you can see the rate here is $1.04 versus $1.36. And so it's really a legacy thing, and we just have been adjusting rates by inflation.
Okay, so then when you've set up these rates way back when, and they've gone up
CPI or right. Whatever the inflation area is.
And how does recycled water play into this?
So
if, for instance, you're in Temecula and you're pumping the recycled water all the way up to Winchester, how does that play in?
So,
no, it's a great question, Dr. Corona. So a couple of thoughts. One is, as you indicated, it's an integrated system now. We can move the recycled water throughout our system based on where the demand is. But the way our rate structures are together is the recycled water customer is, or at least that service product line, is responsible for pumping once we've treated the water to meet regulatory requirements. So once that water exits the wastewater plant or the reclamation plant. At that point, it's the cost to pump the recycled water to whatever the demand is in the system. That is allocated to within the recycled water product line, not the wastewater. So that's how we structured it. So when we talk about, and I know we haven't talked about recycled water rate increases because we did a rate study last year, and we...
Because we don't want to raise recycled water.
Right. So we had that discussion last year, but essentially the pumping cost for recycled water is part of the recycled water product line, not part of the reclamation cost.
Okay, so we're talking apples and oranges here. And
they're separate.
We'll be talking about the oranges the next time.
Yeah,
right. They're separate. And just... maybe not 100% apples and oranges because, as you know, sewer does have a transfer to recycled water, right? Roughly 3.5% of revenue. So where a rate is higher, the individual in Paris is contributing a little bit more to recycled water versus Sun City as an example. So,
well, the pumping from Temecula, it's a long way to go, and it's probably the highest lift.
And it's built into the recycled water rate, what we're charging. So
okay. Thank you.
All right, any other questions for Mr. Adams? Excellent presentation. Look
Thank
forward
you.
To the next one.
All right.
Thank you.
Appreciate the feedback. All right. We will go on to item number 6 on our agenda, which is to receive and file various reports. I'll make a motion for
Second.
That. Second by Director Corona. Megan, a roll call vote, please.
Aye. Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Calendar review, Jennifer.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. I have one event for your consideration. It is this Friday, St. Patrick's Day, is the Riverside County Water Task Force drought update. So if anybody is interested, please let me know and I will add that to your calendar.
I will definitely want to be on that.
I have you and Armstrong already.
Okay.
So Director Slauson, I will add you this afternoon.
Thank you.
So turning to page 2 is the board master calendar for the next 2 weeks. Please review this information and let me know if you have any changes or updates. On the top of page 3 are the upcoming events and participants and conferences through May. Noteworthy is Western Riverside Council of Government has opened their registration for the General Assembly that will take place in Temecula at Pechanga. That flyer is located at the back of your packet. If you're interested, please let me know so I can register you for the event. It will be June 29th. Continuing on page 3 is the board and board committee calendars. Please note that tomorrow's executive committee is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And May 3rd's Board of Directors meeting has been canceled. And then May's Administrative Committee meeting has been rescheduled to May 10th at 3:30 in the afternoon. So all other meetings through May are on schedule. And lastly, on page 4 is the interagency. Please note there, we are still rescheduling the Elsinore Valley joint meeting that is currently scheduled for April 10th. So... And EMWD's offices will be closed on May 29th for Memorial Day. So, any questions?
Thank you, Jennifer.
That concludes my report.
Very good. Let's go to board attendance reports. We will start with Director Armstrong.
Hey, I attended the Menifee Valley Chamber of Commerce Wake Up meeting. That was held here at Eastern in our boardroom. And Amanda Fine made a presentation. It was pretty well attended meeting, and she did just an absolutely great job, gave a big overview of Eastern, but really talked about supply and talked about our projects and our initiatives, etc. And the participants here were really engaged and asked a lot of questions, and she really did a really, really great job communicating all of that. So that was really well done. The Met meetings, this last 2 days was really the first time that Met's board meetings and committee meetings were sort of back to normal. A lot of more board members attended in person. It's still virtual, but there was a lot more participation in person. One big, action that took place relates to the supply picture. So Met's demand for the year for sales is 1.56 million acre feet, but due to the weather and really the weather. There's been a decline in demand in their service area, so their new projection is about 1.44 million acre feet, so about 120,000 acre feet less. That, coupled with the improvements in our supply picture and the allocation from the State Water Project, which at 35% is expected to go up to some much higher level, Met is looking at potentially thinking they're going to have about 800,000 acre feet of excess water this year, which can now go to storage and go to the programs that, Joe, you mentioned earlier. And so it's a really good picture there. That led to an action item to remove the water shortage emergency condition, remove, terminate all the emergency water conservation programs and applicable penalties. So that happened yesterday. That would have expired, I think, in June if no action was taken. But a lot of discussion that it just doesn't make sense to have that in place right now, given the water supply picture. And a lot of discussion taking place on how to message that and how to message, are we really, is it drought? Is it weather changes, climate change, and what people need to do still going forward? So that part hasn't been determined yet, but good action there. And the last thing I'd report from that was, you know, again, still things settling down, still committees being formed and assigned. And I did get assigned yesterday to the Bay Delta subcommittee, so I'm excited about being able to participate in that. And I think that would be beneficial for Eastern to be on that committee. So those are my updates.
All right. Thank you very much, Director Corona.
Okay. So I have a Rancho California Water District meeting. The highlight of that was a discussion on the endorsement for LAFCO, and it was quite the show. And it turned out that the Rancho endorsed Carolee Brady for the number one spot, and another motion by Jack Hoagland to have Carolee Brady as the number one pick, me as the number two pick, and to support Castillo Estrada. But that ended up going by the wayside, and they ended up solely endorsing Carolee. And that was it. So that was it. That was it.
Okay. Thank you. I attended the WRCOG Executive Committee. The speaker they had that day was someone from an executive at CARB, giving a whole report on all the new great electric vehicles that are being mandated on local government. And he got quite a lot of pushback from most of the cities and myself and Director Dunstedt, again, informing them that there's no such thing as an electric ladder truck for fire, and there's no such thing as some of our equipment for cleaning out sewage and other things. So hopefully it was a bit of an education, but it was just kind of, to me, interesting that you had a lot of cities pushing back to say, you're getting way ahead of what's available out there, and we need these vehicles to provide the services we do. So that was interesting. I had a good meeting with the general manager, who was, I want to thank again, he had just gotten back from Atlanta and met me for breakfast, and he probably could have rearranged that for his schedule, but that's okay. Appreciate it. And then, as Joe mentioned, we did have a really good meeting with Nuevo Water Company, and I am trying to do a little more outreach to some of our sub-agencies and people that buy water from us and just check in to make sure they're getting the services that we want them to get. And it just turned out to be a good meeting with probably more to come, so... Director Record is not here, so Director Slauson.
Yes, thank you. I attended the Marina Valley Hispanic Chamber of Commerce breakfast. Mayor Cabrillo gave the presentation, the city update, Ulysses Cabrera, I should say, rather. Attended SAPA and the SAPA Project Authority 24. Primarily, that was in person, by the way, primarily discussed was the general funds budget. And had the update with our general manager and got additional information on a lot of items, and attended the briefing with Supervisor Exchen Gutierrez. And I'm really happy he's our supervisor. I think it was very productive, and it was a good introduction for him of the whole district.
Very good. Do we have any director's comments or future agenda items?
Just to follow up on your update, I didn't actually know there was a Nuevo water.
It's a mutual water company that services that area for, I think they had about 1,700
connections? 1,900 customers.
1,900 connections. So
would
mostly
there,
ag.
Yeah, would there be, could we get a list of any sub-agencies or other agencies that we provide service to?
Absolutely. We'll put that together.
Yeah. That's right.
Any other future agenda items, director's comments? Seeing none. I understand from legal counsel we had a need for closed session today.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9, existing litigation, Garin versus EMWD.
Very good. So why don't we take 5 minutes to switch over to closed session? Okay, we're coming back into open session. Can I ask legal counsel to report out of closed session?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9 to discuss existing litigation, Garin versus EMWD. A report was given to the board, and the board gave instruction to counsel. No formal action was taken by the board. That concludes my closed session report.
All right, with that, we will stand adjourned until April 5th.